There's no I in team, but there is an I in pie. There's an I in meat pie. So the anagram of meat is team. I don't know what he's talking about. Look, that's it.
Yours, mine, and theirs. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the world's fourth greatest movie podcast. This is Roy, and I can't hear you out of the bloody ear hole in my head.
Hi, everybody. I'm John, and I haven't been this excited since I found out Madonna wrote that song about me.
Hey, Scott. I'm Scott. Geez.
Are you?
I am. But I do have some advice for you guys. You will not have a triumphant podcast until you get Eddie Van Halen.
Oh, that's right. Oh. That's the missing thing. No, that's perfect.
But okay. I think first we have to have a viral podcast, and then we get Eddie Van Halen, right?
But yes, but then you have to learn how to do the viral podcast first.
Can't we just go forward in time to get Van Halen and then deposit him somewhere? Of course, I guess he's dead now.
So we're going to be talking about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which is like the biggest mess of, as far as time travel is concerned, for any movie.
I maintain it's the cleanest time travel movie ever made, actually.
It's up there with both of you. Both of you are right.
Yeah.
Anyway, hey, if you're listening for the first time, this is the Yours, Mine, and Theirs podcast, where we talk about three movies from a weird subcategory. This time we're just doing Scott's movies. We brought Scott on, and he gets to do this one for fun for him, and then in 2 weeks he'll do his community service, and we'll do another weird category. But typically, you guys on the Facebook page, you'll pick a weird category for us, and then you'll pick a movie, and then we'll pick a couple movies, and we have a good time. So today we're talking about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Reservoir Dogs, and Shaun of the Dead. Thanks to Scott.
Yes.
Scott, thank you for your movies.
Yeah, thank you. I'm happy to be here. I will say I didn't necessarily think of a connection, but in a roundabout way, they are all movies about survival.
Oh, that's true.
So,
that's absolutely true. Yeah.
I never thought of that.
So we got that going for us.
Yeah, totally.
So Scott's been involved with the podcast for a while as far as on the Facebook page, and it's his fault, I'm assuming, that we had to watch Rocky V.
Partially my fault, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and reveal your voting history. What were your favorite ones to vote on?
my favorite ones to vote on historically were always the ones that would be Zoe's least favorite ones to watch. So I apologize to you two. That was strictly just out of spite for Zoe.
You know what? All is forgiven if that's your reason. I can think of no better reason to vote than that, actually.
Yeah.
So that's perfect. And okay, what else did I have to ask you? I had to ask you, I want to, okay, and I'm really sorry you weren't on last time because you know, we talked about Depeche Mode 101, and you had a few thoughts about that. Really quick, your connection, I mean, I've known you for like 15 years or whatever, you know, because, you know, we've been friends and neighbors and everything, you know, we've been in Salt Lake, we've been dealing with Salt Lake County, you know, this whole time. But I think you only met Roy once, and it was at the Depeche Mode concert.
Yep.
And we mentioned this last time, and I still maintain that. Yeah, I still don't think you wear the concert T-shirt of the band.
So I was going to say that Scott and I have a long history that involves 3 hours at a Depeche Mode concert.
Yeah.
So I think possibly the more egregious error, honestly, is probably that I was wearing Crocs, which are really comfortable. But I still like.
But they were Knights of Reb Crocs, and so I appreciated it more.
I still like vehemently disagree. Like again, like if I go to a sporting event, I'm gonna wear the gear for the team I support. I just don't see how it's different at a concert.
I think it's different because it's music. Because like in sporting events, it's like there are winners and losers. But in music, it's more of a community thing. It's like, hey, I'm at this Depeche Mode concert, but what I want to communicate to the other Depeche Mode fans is that I extend out from Depeche Mode by wearing my Knights of Reb T-shirt or my David Bowie T-shirt or whatever. And so I think that's what it is.
I feel like, though, if I was at the Survivor / what was it? Larry and the Scorchers? What was that dumb band?
Larry and the Cruisers? Eddie and the Cruisers?
No, something in the Scorchers. Why can't I remember the name? But anyway, yeah, a concert I went to was Survivor, and they were opened by, we're going to say Larry and the Scorchers, who were terrible. I think I would feel like I need to wear a Survivor shirt to make sure that the Scorchers, Jason and the Scorchers, they don't even like remotely think that I'm cheering for them.
Yeah. That makes sense.
You can wear like a Johnny Rotten. You can like spray paint "I hate" on the
so
on the Jason.
Who are our opening bands for Depeche Mode anyway? I missed one of them because of traffic, but I can't even remember who opened for them. Was it Stabbing Westward?
Stabbing Westward opened 1 year.
That
was it
like
that 15 year?
15 years ago. The California trip when we saw him in San Francisco, it was Crystal Castles.
Was it? So I don't care.
Yeah, it was that had one song where Robert Smith guested as on the vocals, and I was so curious. I'm like, we got to see Crystal Castles, because what if Robert Smith like opens for Depeche Mode?
So
that's not the case.
Which concert was it where Poe opened? Was that the singles or was that Exciter? That was Exciter, right? Because I thought Poe was a great opener.
That was singles. I want to say that was singles.
I think it was Exciter because
I think it was Exciter.
Because Stabbing Westward, I think I saw Stabbing Westward twice. What if you ever saw Stabbing Westward? That would have been the singles because Stabbing Westward opened for them in 93 when I saw them Songs of Faith and Devotion, 94 whatever that was.
So I think Poe was great, and maybe the best part was her brother who recited the poetry, just like standing on the stage awkwardly dancing. That was so good.
You know, I forgot that they opened for them, and I was a big fan of Poe at the time, so yeah. that was a fun show.
Yeah.
Poe is like in a long line of like singer-songwriter women that you just like, oh, this is the girl I love this year, you know? Like, I think there was like one a year for, you know, in all of the 2000s, I can think of the singer girl that I was in love with, you know, up to 2021. It's just like there's one a year.
Yeah.
So was that 2013 when we saw them? And it was, wasn't it? In California?
I don't think so.
I'm looking up tour dates right now. So Crystal Castles opened for them in 2013, but it doesn't seem like
2009 or 2010 would make more sense for when I would be in California without my.
This
family.
Was after I got married, though, and I got married in 2011. So I think it was 2013, and that's if John is right. Crystal Castles, well, he has to be. Shoreline Amphitheater, Mountain View, San Francisco, California, September 26, 2013.
Never doubt me. I wasn't in San Francisco. I mean, the concert wasn't in San Francisco. It was in that it was where Google's headquartered.
That's San Francisco.
Yeah, the greater San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Yeah, as far as we're concerned, everything north of LA is San Francisco.
So that means for that concert, my family was in California, and I ditched them for the night to go with you guys to that show.
Yes.
So that's cool. Okay. Hey, we sometimes do this. I'm just curious what movies you guys have seen in the last couple of weeks. I've been plowing through some artsy stuff, so I saw All the King's Men. Have either of you seen that? That's kind of a crazy film.
All the King's Men? Isn't that the one that... Isn't James Gandolfini... Wait, isn't that the... Isn't...
It's an old movie about like a hayseed guy who runs for office, and then he makes it the governor, and like at the drop of a hat becomes the most corrupt governor ever.
Of course. No, I never saw it, but they remade it like 10 years ago, and it was, and it was a dismal, you know... obvious failure.
So I saw A Man for All Seasons, which I think my dad he finally accepts me as his son now. So Wings of Desire, which is what City of Angels was remade from.
Yes.
That was pretty good. Yeah, and then Jules and Jim, which is the Frenchest movie I've ever seen. And then I think just yesterday I finished The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. Which I guess is the third movie with Catherine Deneuve I've ever seen. She's the girl in Repulsion as well.
And how was that one? I've been meaning to actually watch that one for a while.
Okay, so like it's a French musical, but there's no songs. It, like every single word is sung, so I swear the director just said, okay, here's your lines, make sure you sing something to it. Right? Like it just feels like it's like
So it's like that improv game in drama. It's like now you have to sing.
It's like Will Ferrell in Elf when he's like, are you going to sing the song? He's like, okay, I'm singing the song. But I will say, like, what the movie looks like everything in the movie looks like cotton candy. It, like, the colors are just crazy. So it's fun to watch. Hmm. And next up on my list is Lady Bird. Looking forward to it. That's what I've been up to.
You never saw Lady Bird?
No, but I will tomorrow.
It's adequate. I've only seen a couple movies since we talked last. I for my movie club, we watched a couple of weird ones. One of them is Altered States, William Hurt's movie, where he goes into a sleep deprivation tank and then alters his molecules, and then it gets weird. And then it becomes the aha video at the end. Like, there's a sequence where he's hitting himself against the hallway to knock out the changed molecules of his body, and it's just like the end of the aha video. So, spoilers for that one. I saw a great movie called Dr. Cyclops, and it's the best. It's about a mad scientist, and then some other scientists come to help him, and he shrinks them down. And so it's like Honey, I Shrunk the Scientists, and so these little miniature scientists are trying to thwart Dr. Cyclops, and it's great. The dialogue is I can't say the dialogue's great. It's terrible. And I saw Black Widow. I participated in someone's Disney Plus where they bought it, and watched Black Widow. It was all right. I don't know if you guys saw it.
So here, yeah, I did see it, and here's like the argument I'm now having with myself, because it would have been $30 to watch it at home, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm really, it's important to me to go to the movie theater and to take my family to the movie theater, but it also cost us $100 to see it in the movie theater. Because I got so many stupid kids, right?
Yeah, you do.
So, like, part of me is like, okay, I'm not sure that, like, my morals, my movie-going morals are worth $70. So, but anyway.
So you did just watch it at home?
No, we went to the movie theater.
You did go to the theater. Okay. There's a weird thing about... Okay, I don't know about this. I almost hesitate to say this, but whatever. I'll say it. And, I mean, everything I do, I regret saying. So I'll say this, but I thought it was strange. I was thinking that Scarlett Johansson was, like, she had a smaller waist, but also kind of a bigger booty at the same time. She was more of an hourglass, shall we say. So her training produced, like, I don't know, I'm thinking she did a lot more sit-ups, she did something, she has this tiny little waist, and then she kind of has, you know, she kind of has the junk, you know, back there and everything. I'm like, okay, that's interesting, you know, because she's pretty curvy, but I felt she was curvier in Black Widow. And then I realized in the logo for the movie, I think they sculpted her body perfectly to fit in the hourglass Black Widow icon, specifically for the poster. And I think that's why her body looks that way.
You think when she went to her trainer and showed her trainer the poster and said, I need to look like this hourglass.
I need to fit in this hourglass perfectly. Because if you look at the poster, she's perfectly fitting into the hourglass. Yeah.
I think it's butt pads.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
I guess that, yep. You know, that can happen. But so good for Scarlett Johansson in getting that done.
And, I'm a big fan. Whoever sold the butt pads to her, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I also saw that a couple nights ago. I only paid $18, though, for it.
Nice.
Tightwad Tuesdays. $6 a ticket. Not too bad.
This is the tale where we talk about how cheap we can get into Black Widow. This is like...
Yeah. And I went to the theater that my niece works at, so we got free popcorn and drinks. So it was a nice night out.
So that was your review of the movie. $18
and free drinks. $18 and free popcorn. I certainly liked it more than you, John. But this isn't the Black Widow show, so I enjoyed it for a variety of reasons, but mostly just because of Florence Pugh.
Yeah, she's great.
I sincerely wish it was just her and not Black Widow. And so we'll see. I know we're going to get more of her.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems like it might be her now. So
could be, hopefully.
Yeah, I really look forward to a Black Widow with a Russian accent, like, from now on.
Yeah. A couple other things I saw these last couple of weeks. Bo Burnham's Inside, which was fantastic.
I never finished it because I was almost afraid to. Like, it seriously, it, like, affected me. I'm like, oh, man.
It did go down some dark paths, but he always managed to... to make it funny. So I really, really enjoyed it, and I thought it was pretty, pretty genius.
Especially I hate that guy.
The times. I'm not sure how I feel about him.
I hate him because I've only seen one and a half of his movies, and I'm like, he's really young, and he's just so smart, and he's so tall, and that just bothers me.
Yeah, the thing is with Inside is he doesn't just show off his comedic abilities, he shows off his musical abilities, but then just his production abilities in general. Like, if you believe, and I do, that he did everything that we see on screen, you know, he came up with some pretty creative ideas for a single room location.
Right. And there were so many, like, slow zooms where I'm kind of like, he had to plan on that, too. He must have set it on a timer or something, you know?
Yeah.
Because he's playing a song while he's doing it.
Yeah. Anyways, pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then I caught up with another movie I've been meaning to get around to for a long time, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which I also enjoyed.
That's got to be a good time capsule movie. Like, something from 15 years ago that seems like forever ago.
It does feel, I think it was 2000, I think it's a little bit older than that, I think it was 2002 if I remember right.
Wow.
But it definitely feels like a mid-90s movie. So anyways, liked it quite a bit, big fan of his, so that's really all I've watched lately.
Did either of you get into Fear Street on Netflix?
I haven't yet. I'm still trying to figure it out.
I thought, I saw it, like, advertised, and I thought, oh, that might be something, that's probably something that was made for me, but did you?
Oh, yeah, so I've seen the first two, and I got to watch the third one, but it's like, it kind of has kind of a Stranger, it's like Stranger Things plus Sleepaway Camp, right?
Oh, I love Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah, I'll say that. I mean, and then there's like this narrative that goes through all three films. But the scene that I talked to you about before, John, where like the death by like meat slicer. It's not meat slicer. It's bread slicer. And I'm not sure a bread slicer can do what it does, but it's really gross. It's one of the grossest things I've seen in a while. But
bread
anyway,
slicer. So like it slices bread someone slicer, into death, 12 pieces. I guess.
And then they bake the toast and they eat it. It's pretty cool. So.
That's cool. Okay, I'll check it out. Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, it's R.L. Stein, right? He's the Goosebumps guy, and I guess before he did Goosebumps, he did this, and it's pretty legit. I like it. So.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Well, you guys ready to talk about Scott's movies?
No.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, it's been good.
No, I have one more thing. I've got one more thing. I have to talk about our viewer mail.
Oh yeah, that's right. You got a viewer mail, a real letter.
A real letter. Yeah,
like
from someone who
mail,
knows John's
mailbox.
Address.
I got which I mean, I guess I'm not surprised. I'm not really too secret about my address. It is kind of weird because, like, you know, because I don't leave, you know, the house or anything. But I got like an actual letter in the mail addressed to your, mine, and theirs. Care of John Madsen, and then it goes on to list the rest of my address, which I'm nervous to actually say out loud now.
So now I wonder then if they think that your address is our studio.
Because it's a care of studio in a sense, yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. So it's dated July 16, 2021, and I open it up. There's a letter it's typed that says, "Dear John and Roy, I just wanted to drop a note and let you know I have been enjoying your wonderful movie podcast! ! Especially the recent movie commentary about the Depeche Mode documentary. You guys should really do more of those." Okay, yeah, we should probably do more commentaries.
More Depeche Mode commentaries?
More Depeche Mode commentaries. We could do a Depeche Mode, like, devotional tour commentary. That'd be cool.
And I've got Depeche Mode in Berlin, and I think I have Depeche Mode in Paris, so...
One Night in Paris.
Yeah,
Devotional is still my favorite. You should do that one.
Yeah. Okay, we'll have to do that. Maybe. Okay, it goes on. "I'm only sad that I don't have a Facebook account and therefore can't participate in the community there. Perhaps you all could have a meetup sometime IRL. That might be a fun way to monetize your podcast, ? Other shows apparently make some money doing live shows." Okay, so the thing is, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. This person obviously is a fan enough to write in, but also... perhaps not a fan enough to Like, because in real life, the whole reason this podcast exists is because one of us does not exist. And that's you, Roy, because you're not here, because you're across the country. So we can't technically have a meetup because we only record when we're far away from each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. Like, we've been in the same city before, and recording absolutely doesn't happen when that happens.
We don't do that. We do, like, important, like, normal life things instead of this.
Yeah.
This is our side life. Yeah.
I mean, I've known John since I was, I guess, 10 years old, right? And then I graduated college, and I moved out of Utah. And for a while, the Halloween album was our annual contact.
Yeah.
But then fortunately, I decided to watch a bunch of crappy Star Trek. And so it's been nice to keep touch through podcasts.
Right.
Yeah. When we're together, I don't think we've ever recorded together.
Right. Which is, I still regret packing the soundboard along with me when we went and watched this new Star Trek movie together because it did rip a hole in my bag. So, that's not going to happen. We don't do that. Okay, the letter goes on. Again, thank you for producing such a great movie podcast. I appreciate all the hard work you do. Joke's on you. We do not work hard, so thanks. sincerely yours, comma, Mr. Onimus of Dogpatch and Lower Slobovia. This is someone in Salt Lake, so I can think of a few things. My friend Mark might he's listened to some of my past podcasts before. Mm. Also, I'm thinking your brother Josh, this might be something that they would do. JB would certainly do this. I'm trying to think of who else in Salt Lake. I guess Brooke could have done this, but...
It doesn't sound like Brooke's voice, does it? Or no. Zoe's. It doesn't sound like either of them.
Yeah, Zoe could have done it. He would have been really bored to do this.
There's not a single...
Zoe would put that much effort out there.
Yeah, no.
There's not a single bad pun, and no references to robot jocks, so I don't know if it's Flinders.
It's not Flinders. There's no mention of the Corys, so it's not Josh.
All right.
We'll have further mention of the Corys in the future. So anyway, okay. So thank you very much for the letter. That was really exciting. Sorry that you don't have Facebook or email, apparently. Okay. It will. And also, we also need to know how live things work because... Oh, here's the other reason why we won't do an IRL thing, because... it would be really embarrassing for you, letter writer, to be the only person to show up for that. maybe let's give it a 6 months to a year and see where we're at, and then we can do the live thing. Certainly, that would be super fun, but also we don't know how it works or how to do it.
So. Yeah, well, like the live thing is step three, but step two is Eddie Van Halen, right?
I thought
which is now going to be
profit.
More difficult. The profit. Okay.
Yeah, okay. We still need. Yeah. Once we get Van Halen, we'll be live. We'll definitely be live. So that'll be good.
Yeah. All right, Scott. For your first movie chronologically, which is the way we do things, you picked. There's your waveform, Sean. You picked. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Bill and Ted's. Yes.
Very good. Okay, so Bill and Ted's opens up. Maybe the greatest way you can possibly open up any film ever with Breakaway by Big Pig.
Yeah. There's something about that song where you're just like, this is going to be a really serious, gritty movie.
Yeah, it certainly opens up much dark, not darker, but yeah, different tone with the, the golden obelisk of sorts.
Which... I guess we should ask. I don't know what that weird golden thing is. Are we supposed to be worshipping that?
I don't know, but it comes through like the giant ceiling butthole, right?
Yeah.
It's like the flag for Greendale Community College. So,
I can only imagine too, though, that music magic or sorry, movie magic. That thing is 3 feet tall.
It's in danger of being trod upon.
Yeah, in danger. Yeah, exactly. Thank you. You know where I'm going.
Yeah. So anyway, the point is, it's the future, and they're aware of an event that's going to happen in the past that has to that requires their interference. Which I don't understand how that's a thing, because if the future already exists, like with them having succeeded, then why is there something in the past? Like, I don't see an original timeline that would have led to the future we're looking at. So there must have been an original timeline where the future sucked. Someone figured out why and went back and fixed it, and now we're seeing that loop again.
So it's 12 Monkeys.
Yeah, yeah. Or Legit. Legité.
Well, yes. Here's my new theory on it. I was thinking of this just today, because the time travel in Bill and Ted's is very specific. It's like everything happens. Like, they don't, as far as I can tell, they don't change anything.
No.
You know, there are no new timelines created. And so the people of the future, I think they weren't really concerned that Bill and Ted wouldn't pass the history thing. They know they passed it because it's written in history. They didn't have to do anything. But I think my new canon is that Rufus won a contest to, hey, let's go back in time and meet Bill and Ted and give them the keys to time travel so they can pass history. But don't worry, if you don't do that, they're going to do that anyway. Because
they're going to do it
anyway. Yeah.
You think they passed their history exam without the intervention? Because, like, so here's the plot. Bill and Ted are really dumb.
They didn't. Well, because there was an intervention. That's the only thing. There's no if. That's the only thing that ever happened.
Hmm.
And so they can't say, "Oh, if we don't do this, it won't happen," because it did happen. So therefore, yeah.
But see, this is the problem with time travel movies in general. Is
yeah.
there's this inherent loop, right? But where does the loop start?
Yeah, so that's the problem. So like when we're talking Terminator, right? Terminator is the opposite idea. And wow, we're actually having a serious time travel discussion with Bill and Ted. So in Terminator, the future happens the good guy's way, and the bad guys figure, oh, we have to go back and change the past. But in this movie, the future happens correctly, but someone goes back in the past to it doesn't matter.
To make sure it happens correctly.
To make sure? So why do you gotta make sure if it already happened?
But yeah, you don't have to make sure. But
so
you do.
It's basically a multiverse is the answer, right?
No,
so,
no, it's a monoverse.
No, it's
Look,
a multiverse.
There are no other alternates here. It's like this happened in the past because someone in the future came and made it happen in the past. It never didn't happen in the past from someone... Like,
but
someone in the future never didn't come back from the future.
You have to get to that first future. You have to arrive at that first future first.
Well, it doesn't really
Unless,
make
like,
sense.
All
I mean,
time
okay,
is happening
okay first of all, let me just put this caveat out there. Time travel is not possible.
Okay.
But...
So another problem with the time travel in this movie is they can travel anywhere in time they want, but time in San Dimas is still moving, and there's nothing they can do about it, which also doesn't make sense because they do... I mean,
that doesn't make sense. That's just that something
makes,
well, they say. But
yes
I,
and no,
yeah.
Right? Because they actually show up. So when they meet themselves at Circle K,
yeah,
the time traveling versions of themselves came back to a time in San Dimas that did not move forward like they speak it or like they say it is.
Yeah.
You know, they say that they're 8 hours behind. Here's the whole point of winding the watch, which turns out to never make
doesn't make
difference.
Any difference.
But so. So it's both. Time does stop in San Dimas, and it also continues forward. So, yeah, there's a few problems, but and time travel is possible, John.
Well, okay. Time travel might be possible, but, well...
Theoretically, it's 100% possible.
Okay, the question is, if time
physically,
travel were possible, would it work the way it does in Bill and Ted's? Because I've maintained that there is only one universe and there are no multi-universes, because that's the way this movie presents it, because everything that happens is not something that can ever be... Like, you can't change anything by time travel. Like, you can't change anything. You can plan for the future by time traveling and doing something... But just because you planned for the future doesn't mean you wouldn't have done it in another universe or alternate timeline. There are none of those things.
Well, and this is why most time travel movies, they get something wrong. And Bill and Ted's is certainly no exception. But back to kind of my loop idea is and to what Roy is saying is in order for this future to... That the futurists that are current in order for this future to exist, they have already had to have gone back in time and told Bill and Ted what to do to pass their test.
Yeah.
John, you're arguing. We're just going to go in circles, but that's the point. Is
the point is the circle? Yeah.
The point is the circles. But so the one part of the movie that always, even as a kid, that threw me off was when they get to the police station. They're trying to release, and I know I'm jumping ahead here, but
yeah.
They're trying to release everyone that's been captured. And he says, "You know," he says, "remind myself to hide the keys."
You mean the best part of the movie?
You guys are taking all my unanswered questions.
I had this written down too. Of course,
I had three of them, and now two of them are gone. So, can you verbalize the future? Can you verbalize the future
if you're Bill and Ted, if you have access to a time machine, you can do pretty much anything you want.
So, yeah. But here's the question, right? Because like they're saying, okay, when this is all done, we're going to do this and we're going to come back in time and place it here and voila, it's there, right? But after it's all done, if they're unsuccessful the first time, do they have that choice? Whatever. So the point
then
is
find the keys. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, they like, because they know they can travel in time, they just verbalize it and it happens, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's that simple.
That simple. Okay. So, okay, I've only got one unanswered question left, so we got to leave it alone.
I had one just really quick question. Because, sure. Steele, I know you're in the time travel community. You've been telling me this for years. Okay, but my question to you is, if time travel were possible, would it work this way? Or would it work the Back to the Future way?
It works the somewhere in time way.
Work in what way are you talking?
Like, you can change the past, or you can change a version of the past. You can create, or you can create new realities.
So, according to classical physics, the way time travel would work, and I know if you got any physics professors on your listening board, I'm going to get beat up here, but the only way to
physically beat them up. I know that.
The only real way to physically time travel is actually to approach the speed of light, right? Which we know is physically impossible. But all that does is it slows time down, and if you get to the speed of light, it would stop time. So once you slowed down, you would actually be at a point in the past, but you would not have existed in any point between the point you are now and the point that the people in the future are when you left them. Does that make sense?
No.
So if I went speed of light for 1 year, I would, and then all of a sudden I stopped speed of light, came back to normal speed, I would exist on this date, July 22nd, 2021. You guys would exist on the date, July 22nd, 2022. I would not have any knowledge of what happened between July 22nd, 2021 and 2022.
So the question is,
so
it's someone observing you, someone in our universe, not traveling through time, would they witness you traveling through time before you did it?
They would witness, I think it would be opposite. They would witness everyone around me traveling forward in time and me not. I guess it depends, because the thing with relativity,
cryogenics, really.
Yeah. With relativity is relativity is named relativity because exactly what you said, John, is it's all on a point of view, how I view you and how you view me. So depending on who's moving that viewer, if he's moving differently from me, then he would definitely see me moving through time. If he is in the same, frame of reference of everyone else, then things look differently.
Right, so you can't change anything, you can just see things in the past.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's
not to say that there isn't some possible way, we just don't know, of creating a machine to change time. I would like to think that's not possible, but 100 years ago, mankind knew nothing about black holes. They didn't exist, and 100 years later, it's very well evident.
We've created so many black holes.
We've created so many black holes. But my point is, who knows where we'll be 100 years from now. So, but as of right now, I would say the only physical way to time travel is by approaching the speed of light.
100 years from now may only be 50 years from now.
True.
So this is the Planet of the Apes theory of time travel.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Right. Okay, Planet of the Apes, that's the one that got it right.
Yeah. So then, like the idea of a machine that helps you travel through time, also the idea is that if at any point in the future that were possible, we would probably already know, right, if it were possible to travel back in time.
Yeah, and that's one of the big, so there's a – within physics, there's a lot of known paradoxes. The grandfather paradox is kind of the biggest one that most people know about, and regarding you can't go back in time and change things because you can't go back in time and kill Hitler because then in the future there would be no Hitler for you to go back in time to kill, right? Like, but the idea is if we had time traveled, we would already know. Unless it's like some big secret is kind of the answer to that, but
unless time cop.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anyway, this is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Keep
and their theory of time travel is a phone booth. So the point is they're in a band called Wild Stallions. It sucks really bad because they suck really bad. And we talked about this. They think two things. They need Eddie Van Halen or they need their video to be big. And one is going to make the other happen. And so they're kind of talking about going viral, which I don't know how that happens on a VHS tape that you create in your basement, because there's no internet here, right? Like, but they're creating
they're
a video.
They're ahead of their time.
They're ahead of their time, right? They're going to go viral, and then they'll have Eddie Van Halen. The problem is they're going to flunk school. If they flunk school, by the way, I think they're told specifically they're going to flunk out of school. I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, don't you get held back a year? Can you flunk out of school? But if Ted flunks, he's off to a military academy in Alaska. So that's the end of Wild Stallions. And it turns out that's a disaster for the future because they create this utopian future.
I don't know how they would know that, though. There's really only one universe.
So anyway, with the help of time travel, they go back into the past and they collect a bunch of world leaders. And they don't really give a history. I mean, they kind of give a few facts, right? But they don't really give a report at all. They just have these historical figures kind of present. But it's still like, even though I think that's pretty crummy and like they're not really contributing much other than like here's our guest speakers speaking for us, it's still better than a lot of the other speeches, right? Like I think one of them,
the best speech ever.
San Dimas is more moderner. San Dimas High School football rules.
The fact that they would perceive the world bigger, but also smaller because computers. And then the San Dimas High School football rules. That's like a Hall of Fame speech.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, that's pretty much it. They get these figures from the past to give their report. And all's well. They pass their class, and Ted doesn't go off to military school. So I just want to say, like, I love Ted's hair cut, and I'm shooting for that now that I can grow my hair out again. I'm going for the Ted. So that'll be pretty exciting. Now, is his...
Are you growing your hair now that you've retired?
I sure am. I haven't cut it since I retired. Nice. So, is his name Ted Theodore Logan? Like, he has three parts to his name, or is it?
I read it as his name is
Theodore Logan.
Yeah, but he goes by Ted. But his nickname is Theodore in his own mind. Yeah, like okay. I just think he doesn't know how to use quotes in names.
Okay, so and Bill Preston Esquire, like. That's a title for like a lawyer in
for a lawyer, yeah.
Or something, right? I don't know. Like I don't think you can just be an Esquire.
Yeah.
But anyway, he is.
Found a way.
Yeah. So I mean, that's the movie, right?
Okay, you missed how Rufus time traffics women to the present.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
So I was disappointed. So actually at the end of this movie, I went and saw Face the Music, which I enjoyed. I really liked it.
I enjoy Face the Music. I saw it on a plane. I saw it on the plane, like on the way back from Virginia when I went and saw it.
Yeah. I was hoping like the princesses would continue through the three films, but it's a different set of actors.
It's different. Yeah.
Yes. That bothers me. Yeah. We'll get there. Face the Music, but I do, I love their kids. I think their kids are really great. So.
I love Roided Out. Epic, so. I love Roided Out Prison, Bill and Ted. I think that's pretty great.
The thing that really works for that movie for me is there's been a handful of movies where sequels come many, many years later. And a lot of them fail for a lot of reasons, in my opinion. But this one works primarily because Bill and Ted are similar, but they've grown, right? They've grown and they've kind of accepted themselves. And I think there's a lot of movies where, comedically wise, I can think of one big example with Jim Carrey. Dumb and Dumber. Yeah, the most recent Dumb and Dumber to me was a big fail because the people that made that movie kind of said, you know what, let's just give the people the same characters, just now they're older. Nothing's changed. But Bill and Ted did change. And they have come to accept, that's why it's called Face the Music, right? They've kind of come to accept their shortcomings, their failures, to a degree. So they grew in the last 30 years. They didn't just give us the same characters and think that we'd be okay with that.
Yeah, so part of their characters, right? And a major part of their characters is they basically talk like Valley Girls, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, so can I ask you guys, like, that's a major part of the humor of this film. Is that a funny thing to you guys? Like, is it funny to you? So I guess I'm going to say, to me, it's not. Like, like I really don't care that they talk like that, but that's like a major part of the humor here.
It works for me just because that's, I attached myself to this movie at such an early age that's who Bill and Ted are. I didn't see it as a Valley Girl thing. The only way I describe it is it's Bill and Ted. It's just who they are, and so for me it works really well.
I think it's necessary for the type of movie it is, but I think that was kind of a problem when it first came out, because I think the perception of the humor of the movie was that, like, okay,
it's dumb humor.
Yeah, it's dumb. My stepfather would say, all the humor in this is dumb, but I still haven't been able to convince him that, hey, if it makes you laugh, it's good, whatever.
Yeah.
I remember, like, my brother making fun of Bill and Ted because he was doing the Valley talk when he was talking. But the funny parts of this movie are, it's not the way people talk, it's the absurdity of the situation and all of that.
My sister-in-law is a very good example of kind of what you're talking, because my brother took her to see Face the Music last year. I was talking to him afterwards. I'm like, what'd you think? And she says, that was the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And I was like, oh, come on. She says, I hated how they talked. I hated this. I hated that. I'm like, oh, come on. And I was like, well, hold on. Like, you've seen Bill and Ted's, right? She says, no, I've never seen any of them. I'm like, oh, okay. Now it makes sense.
That's like, that was a huge mistake. I mean,
exactly. I told my brother that.
Yeah, your brother, right? Wait, was this Zach?
No, this is my older brother, Brandon.
Okay. Oh, that's funny.
I think, again, where I watched this in... What year was this? 91?
This was... No, Bill and Ted's... The Excellent Adventure was 88, I think.
89. No, 89. 89. I was a ripe age of 11 years old when this movie came out. And not only that, this movie plays differently in 89 than it does in 2021, right? Like, it's... The comedy of the 80s and all that, but all that made sense to me. If I had watched it like my sister-in-law brand new last year, it wouldn't have hit as well. I can say just for myself it works, but
yeah. So absolutely, and I'm not saying the film doesn't work and it's not funny. I think one of the funnier parts of this film is the character of Missy, right? And I love Missy and Face the Music too. And that's actually the same actress, but, I love that his stepmother, he had previously asked her to the prom and I think Missy's great. And one of the best scenes with Missy is when like they, she's there helping them give a ride to all these famous historical figures, and they make up a bunch of stupid names, and they get to Abraham Lincoln, and they're just like, and Abraham Lincoln, and she just like doesn't even bat an eye, right?
Well, but she knows. I mean, that's the one person she would have recognized.
Yeah,
you know? And so like, what else can you say? But what else could you call him but Abraham Lincoln? Like everybody else, like, you know, like no one knows what Socrates looks like. So
yeah,
and so it's kind of like. I mean, I kind of took it as like, okay, well, you know, I think this takes away from the humor of it, but it's sort of like, this is an Abraham Lincoln impersonator that we just, we can't explain, but he's here. You know it's Lincoln. He's right here. We've been to the robot Hall of Presidents at Disneyland.
There was one little touch with Missy that I caught on this time, and maybe I'm overthinking it, but I don't think I am. It's when we first meet her, and it's in Bill's bedroom, and she comes in and delivers them some food. I don't know if you remember what she gave them, but it was incredibly burnt grilled cheese sandwiches. Like, incredibly burnt. And it just I think it was a nice little touch just to kind of show, you know, who she is, how far she is removed from Bill and Ted, really. In not just in age, but just in the world in general, and that's her way of being a homemaker. Mm-hmm. Is what can I do? I can make grilled cheese sandwiches. You know.
Well, my favorite thing about Missy, it's not in this movie, but it's in Bogus Journey, which we've talked about on a different podcast. But I think it's the funniest joke, and you have to see both movies. And I can't even explain if it is a joke or why it's a joke. But the fact that she divorced Bill's dad and married Ted's dad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's I mean, that's funny in a concept, but the fact that Bill's dad and Ted's dad are so completely different. Like, Ted, this is the guy who was sending him, he's this hard-nosed cop, and he was going to send Ted to military school, and he's just a completely different person, but, you know, she's just, like, linked to these dads by these two other guys. It's just, mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's just a funny
thing. And now she's married to Deacon.
Now she's married to, was it Ted's younger brother, Deacon?
Yeah. And that's, you know, the running joke that goes through the first two movies is her insistence on them calling her mom, right? And so it's always, hi, I mean, mom. And she's always kind of gives them a look right before they correct themselves. And
dude, your mom is so hot.
That's one of my favorites.
Well, I mean, I don't. Do you have anything more you guys want to talk about Bill and Ted? So I agree 100%. So like, when we saw this movie as kids, right? Like it was like, I think even the way they talked was really cool, and I'm sure I annoyed the heck out of my parents by talking like that. But so I guess my question then is like, I think you're right, that they simply talk like Bill and Ted, right? Like this is Bill and Ted speak. I'm not sure anyone, like, before this movie really spoke like that?
Well, you said you called it the Valley Girl speak, so I think they spoke like that in the movie Valley Girl.
I think it's similar, but it's, you know, it's a little bit of rock and roll. It's a little bit of, you know, Valley Girl, but what I would define it more as, like, California surf talk, right?
Yeah.
Like, so it's kind of a combination of things. And then to put it all on top, they're just idiots. Right.
Yeah.
So I calling it Valley Girl, I think, is a little limited, but I don't. Yeah, it's Bill and Ted. But to John's point, really, that's not what I love. That's not what makes me love the movie then, and it's not what keeps me loving it now. It's just the It's just the absurdity of the situations that they find themselves in. You know, when they go to medieval England and. You know, one of my favorite moments, put them in the Iron Maiden, you know, and of course their response is excellent. And then somehow he falls down the stairs in that iron suit and falls out of it.
Yeah.
You know,
they didn't have the budget to show that too. It's like
medieval dick. Anyways, just a lot of absurdity and
because they're not the only weird people, like everyone in history is as weird as they are.
Yeah. So, and I think there's a little nuance here that they understand they're not very smart, and there's times where you see them like frustrated and struggling against their limited mental capacity. Right. And I think that's, it's endearing. It's a nice part of the character.
I want to go back to the language because you asked about like people talking this way before the movie. I think that's got to be a hard thing about Face the Music, you know, and your sister-in-law dealing with that is, does anybody talk that way now? Because I remember people talking like that in the 80s, but like surfers now, I mean, this is the next generation. These are those surfers' kids. Surely they don't talk like their dads do. Do they?
Yeah, but no, and that's why my one real complaint about Face the Music is that to what you're saying, John, I don't think his kids or their kids would sound like they did.
Yeah. I mean, unless they never left the home ever, right?
Yeah. You might pick up on a few words here and there, but you know, the girl that played Ted's daughter.
Yeah.
She like completely 100% emulated Ted, right? Like it was
She's and, such a great Ted, yeah, that one.
And she was. She was fantastic. She did a really good job at it, but it definitely felt out of place. Bill and Ted did not. They did.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. So I agree with that.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I guess that's too bad. I think Ted's daughter, I can't remember their names in it. Her name is Billy. They were named after the opposite person.
Billy and Theodora.
Billy and Theodora. Billy was definitely exactly like Ted. Theodora, and I said this because Scott, you know I don't like... What's her name? I don't like that actor.
Samara Weaving.
Because I have dumb reasons. But she... I felt like she was actually just... We're talking about Face the Music now, of course. But she was definitely just different than the three other people. Like, she wasn't as much Bill and Ted-like. She kind of was, like, kind of dumb, but also smart in a different way than the other ones.
Well, she was. And this actually brings me to something that I might bring up a little bit later in the podcast, was... And I don't know if other people do this, but for whatever reason... Whenever I watch Bill and Ted's, any of the movies, I'm kind of glued in on Ted.
Yeah.
I'm kind of glued in on Keanu Reeves. He's the big famous actor, and I'm kind of interested to see what he's doing with the character. I've never really paid attention to what Alex Winters does with Bill. And he's much more subtle, but I would argue, I watched it this last time around, I was paying a lot of attention to him. Much more subtle, but much more effective in... I think being honest to the type of character he's supposed to be. And so in that sense, I would say Alex Winters, you know, is the bigger actor, at least in this particular role.
Interesting. Well, I mean, he can't compare to his role as Marco in The Lost Boys, of course.
Well, of course not. That hair alone is enough to...
Yeah. Okay.
Anyways, I just thought that was interesting. It's hard to watch movies like this and really pick apart someone's acting. You know, Ted, Keanu Reeves, I think, really is kind of hamming it up, and he's very clearly acting, but I feel like Bill came across very natural.
That's just
him.
It's fascinating in a movie like this where these characters are what the characters are to try and judge, like, the quality of the acting, right? I guess let me ask you this, Scott. So please share with us why you chose this film.
Yeah.
It's just always been one of my favorites since I was a kid. I'm a big fan of movies. I'm a big fan of comedies. But it's one of the few movies that I can consistently watch and just never die or never get old of. I will watch this once or twice a year, and I have ever since 1989. It's incredibly quotable. Every time I leave, you know, a family member's house, I yell out, "Say hello to the princesses for me." it's just part of who I am. It really is. I quote it so much, mostly with my brothers, but I just love it.
Did it encourage you to pick up a guitar?
I don't know if this movie specifically did, but sure. I've never thought of that. I do love playing the guitar. I don't exactly know why, but probably Bill and Ted had something to do with that.
Chances are you're significantly better than Bill or Ted.
Well, Bill and Ted in Excellent Adventure, yes. But, you know, by the end of Bogus Journey, when they're beating Primus in a battle of the bands, I mean,
yeah.
I was going to bring that up about Bogus Journey as well, because in Bogus Journey, that's where they disprove the whole San Dimas clock is ticking all the time, because they do just go back in time and wait out the ticking clock until it gets to that point in history again.
Yeah.
That's why, yeah. So that I might ask that question again. What's up with the constantly ticking clock in San Dimas? Because I feel like Rufus says the clock is always ticking because he knew they were making a movie called Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, and the events have to fit within the time frame of a movie.
But so, you realize.
This is a good place to bring up. This movie is 1 hour and 27 minutes, so it does not break the sacred 90-minute barrier. So I don't – if they were, like, trying to keep the movie under a time limit, they probably had a little wiggle room there.
I guess Rufus said it for budgetary reasons as well.
For budget reasons.
So the problem to your thought there, John, is those – they go back to the – that same – time problem in Face to Music.
Yeah, dang it, I can't remember.
The clock keeps ticking in Face to Music.
Yeah.
They've got to be somewhere at some time within.
Yeah, they do.
You know,
yeah, there is the time clock. Yeah.
The only way I've ever looked at it was, the future people are okay with letting them cheat to pass their history final, but they can't cheat time. They still only have X amount of time to do it in. Like, if they wanted more time, they should have planned ahead, sort of thing.
Mm. yeah. Why didn't the future people, like, maybe come to Bill and Ted, like, in junior high?
Yeah.
And, like, by the way, this is who Billy the Kid was, in case they ask.
Listen, you've got 6 years to prepare for this final. It's got to go well.
All right.
Holy
well.
Cow. Well, that was a very serious talk about Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
And I could go on and on and on about the time travel, but that stuff's fun.
Oh, yeah.
But we'll leave that for now.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about time travel and awards more.
Yeah, well, the next time travel movie is Reservoir Dogs, which I think, Scott, you're just going to take this one yourself, right?
No, Scott has Shaun of the Dead.
That's right. Scott has Shaun of the Dead. But if I remember correctly, Scott, this is the first time you've seen this movie?
Yeah.
It was the first time I've seen it, yes.
So myself as well. John, had you seen it before?
Yeah, of course. Of course. No, okay, well, I'll ask you guys at the end, like, how the first time viewing goes. But this is historic, though, as far as the podcast goes, because so far no one has come on with the movies that made them and picked a movie that they had never seen before. So that was a very pioneering move. I'll just say that. Well, and I'll leave it up to you to say, like, you know, during awards, if that was like a good decision or a bad decision.
Yeah.
But Reservoir Dogs, it's famously Quentin Tarantino's first movie, and it's about. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, these guys, you know, there's a lot of criticism about the language in this movie, about how they talk about certain, like, groups of people. But let's be honest, these are the worst guys ever.
Oh, yeah.
They're just terrible, terrible, terrible people. And they have a jewel heist that they're getting together. They have a little pre-meal snack. And it's organized by this guy named Joe, and played by Lawrence Tierney. And he's the worst ever. He's the worst human being. And his kid, nice guy Eddie, turns out not so nice once you get to know him.
Not so possible that Joe is still slightly better than Pink, because Pink refuses to tip waitresses.
Right. That's the one good person.
He's got a point,
really
though.
Really bad person, yeah. About tipping, I've always thought that.
Well, no. Like, he brings up the point about someone that works at McDonald's versus someone that works at a diner.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, but we choose to tip one and not the other.
Right. Well, it's a bigger deal in our state, right? Because I don't know if they still do this, but I think waitresses get way less in Utah than anywhere else, because it's like, oh, because the tipping is factored in.
Yep.
And so so you have to tip here, but I kind of understand. Look, and I get, and I, it's funny, we're having the tipping conversation. I get that, yes, they do, you know, need that, and it's like tips are really big and everything. But no, just pay them better. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's just if yeah. No, I understand everything Pink says, but I don't like the idea that you tip one group of people and you don't tip another group.
Yeah. So there are some states out there that pay waitresses and waiters less than minimum wage. It's not every state, but some states. But I think those states, like, if you have a poor tipping night, you're still guaranteed to make at least minimum wage, but it's pretty crappy.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. And that's how I sold cars for one summer, and that was how they treated us there, too. We didn't get tipped, obviously, but I got a percentage of the sale. But if I didn't make over, basically, minimum wage for the month, they'd give me minimum wage instead of my sales percentage. So I could – there was always a minimum I could make, but – and it was crap. It was literally minimum wage, you know.
Yeah.
But I know with waitresses in Utah – it used to be 280, and I don't know if my guess is it's gone up, but probably not by much. But yeah, it used to be 280 an hour plus tips.
Yeah, you know, in New Zealand they don't tip, like it's a faux pas.
Yeah,
you're supposed to tip anybody. It's like
nice.
Yeah, it's just kind of like culturally, it's like, okay, we've decided that. I mean, because that's the thing, and I think Pink has a good point that, like, when the concept of tipping was invented, it was invented because it was like, okay, you know what? You really went out of your way, and you did a service beyond your job. And so, yeah. Therefore, yeah. You know. And so.
But this is what I love about Tarantino in general, is he's known for talkie movies, but a lot of what is being said a lot of the time has nothing to do with anything. It's just, you know... And it brings up kind of, before you move on from this diner, John, it brings up the bigger point. If you're about to go do something highly illegal, are you going to get all those guys together in a very public place, all dressed in black suits with black ties?
That's a huge goof of the movie. That's a problem. Yeah, no. You don't do that. Also, it's like, okay, you know, it's great that they don't know each other. There's a lot of safety precautions on the job. And it's great, the biggest thing, and it's very clever of Joe to make sure that no one knows each other's names, and they all have code names based on color, and so that way they can't rat each other out. That's very important. But, like you said, getting together, you know, 15 minutes before the heist and having a loud conversation about tipping and, you know, what you're about to do, you know, and everybody in that diner is probably like, if they happen to watch the news that day, then... then they're able to, like, you know, the steps will be made to capture them. And also, you know, in Point Break, you know, they have their uniforms where they cover their faces up with presidents or whatever. But in this, it's the opposite. It's like they draw attention to themselves with matching suits. So I'm not sure if that was the best thing. You know, they should have had, like, the most plain, nondescript clothes, but they stick out like nothing else with their suits. So... anyway, the rest of the gang is as follows. You got Orange. Turns out he's an undercover cop. They shouldn't trust him. White, played by Bad Lieutenant. And, you know, I would call him... he's a veteran, not a professional. Pink. Now, Pink, he's a professional. That's Steve Buscemi. White is played, you know, by Bad Lieutenant. White goes way back with Joe. And Pink, he's just like the guy who just gets stuff done. Brown is a psychopath who was just released out of prison, but the thing about Brown is he is loyal. He was on the fast track to become, you know, like on the cabinet of Trump's presidency, because that's his thing. It's loyalty. And then you got Blue, who has two lines talking about how he didn't really like anything after Borderline with Madonna's work. And then you got Brown, who was Quentin Tarantino himself, who is... he's good at getting shot in the head, but he has a lot of theories about Madonna music. Okay. Oh, and actually, I was going to say this. You know, the thing that's great about Tarantino, but also the thing that I think misunderstood, because this universe where these criminals get together and they talk about Madonna music and they talk about tipping and they talk about, you know, the crazy kahuna's 70s hits that's playing on the radio and these great songs on the radio and all this stuff, and they're laughing, they're having a good time, they're joking around. But like, a lot of people might say that it's like, okay, yeah, you know, if you're criminal, then those are the kind of conversations you have. I kind of think, you know, and there's no way to know this, I think these guys, what they've done in the past and, you know, the kinds of things they're willing to do, I kind of feel like they're soulless enough that IRL, they wouldn't have these fun conversations. I think they're just soulless enough that they wouldn't laugh like that.
Mm. So I'm just going to point out real quick that you said brown twice, and I think...
Yeah, you meant blonde the first time.
Meant blonde,
oh,
yep.
Okay. I always get brown and blonde mixed up. That's fine.
That's your colorblindness.
Well, I
blonde's,
know.
Blonde's a psycho out of prison.
My driver's license says brown hair, but everybody tells me I have blonde hair, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't even know.
It's dirty blonde, John.
To your point, John, I actually think the opposite, that these guys are soulless enough that they wouldn't... It's not that they can't laugh about things or need to laugh about things, but it's that they're so ingrained in their own culture that they have nothing to do. They're not going to sit there and talk about, you know, the hit they did on this or this or that. It's just going to be everyday conversations. They're just normal guys at this point. Amongst themselves, they're normal guys. So it would be kind of like a, you know, the good old boys club sort of thing. And they would sit there and talk about Madonna and tipping. That's kind of my opinion.
I think they talk a lot more about how I think these guys would talk a lot more about how certain groups of people are on jobs than they would talk about Madonna, just because they're that bad, you know?
Well, so possibly, but at this point, when they're on their way to the hit, I would think that they've already talked that stuff out. Right?
Yeah.
Like, the time to do that has passed.
Yeah. I just think that once, you know, when you've done your time and you've, I don't know, when you've killed a cop or whatever, you know, which, and I don't know if these guys have killed cops in the past, but
they make up for it in this movie, though.
Yeah, the fact that they don't really seem fazed at all at the cops they kill in this movie kind of leads me to believe that it's no big deal for them.
Well, it is LAPD.
Right. Yeah, making a recurring thing from the from our OJ movie, the recurring character of the LAPD, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I'll have to do some interviews with some hardened criminals. I just don't think they're really interested in talking about Madonna albums, you know, after when you've just lived that kind of life. Anyway, the point is they do the heist. We don't see the heist. We don't see any of it. It goes terribly wrong. They come back to the meeting place, even though Pink is like, why are we coming back here? The undercover cop is there. They kidnap a cop. They torture a cop. They all meet. They all argue about who the rat is. They know a rat is somebody. All the bosses come. A couple of them die. A couple of them get shot on the way out. And then because Orange, the undercover cop, gets shot and he's dying, the question is, do we take him to a hospital? He knows too much. He swears he's not going to tell anything. They don't know he's an undercover cop. And the argument comes about, like, okay, do we protect this guy or do we not? Mr. White protects him. He shoots everybody down. He gets shot himself. And Mr. Orange, at the end, says, oh, by the way, I'm a cop.
Maybe
it's a bad idea for him, but...
And then White kills Orange as the cops kill White.
Yes. So pretty much everybody dies. Pink gets out, but according to like some things I've read, you hear him get shot by the police, and he says, hey, stop, I've been shot, you know, so Pink doesn't quite get away. So, and Mr. Orange, I didn't mention this, Mr. Orange guns down Mr. Blonde, the psychopath, because Mr. Blonde was torturing that other cop. That's where the argument starts. because he's like, okay, I had to shoot him because he was going to make off with the diamonds. He was going to kill everybody. And that's where Nice Guy Eddie says, you mean this guy who did like 10 years and didn't rat us out, suddenly he decides to rat us out when he gets out? No, that doesn't make sense. And so that's where all the shooting starts. That's where everybody dies. So.
Yep. Yeah, it's like it's the Mexican standoff, except they all shoot simultaneously. Like, they actually all do it.
Yes.
Right.
Okay, now, as promised, Steele, I want to ask you this, because I talked to you about this last night. You had a question for me that I didn't even bother watching for, because I'm just like, oh, everybody shot each other. I didn't really look into the logistics of, because Joe was pointing the gun at Orange, who was lying bleeding on the ground. White mm-hmm. was pointing the gun at Nice Guy Eddie.
No, White was pointing the gun at Joe.
White was pointing the gun at Joe. Nice Guy Eddie was pointing the gun back at White. And he's
correct.
Like, you stop. Put your gun stop away. Don't shoot my daddy. Yeah.
So, yeah. So the question is, and I know the answer to this now. I didn't last night. And I remember hearing about this problem, mm-hmm. you know, 20 years ago. Never bothered to look into it.
I watched the end this afternoon, and I think I have a different take, because I was like, okay, well, Orange, he must have pulled his gun out and shot Nice Guy Eddie. But
okay. I'll give the question to Roy.
Yeah.
There are three people with guns, but three people with guns, four people die.
Orange has got his gun out.
Orange does not have his gun out.
Oh, I thought that Orange had his gun out. No. So, by the way, Orange bleeds like 20 gallons of blood.
Yeah, he does. So, I watched this in slow motion over and over again to try and figure it out. And I know there were people online a long time ago that they did like overhead diagrams to try and prove some things. And so John told me last night it had to have been Orange. But I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, okay, I remember Orange when he shot White. By the way, anytime Michael Madsen dies on screen is like my favorite part of any movie. Okay, so White dying, Blonde dying, glorious. But he empties his gun to a point. And Roy, I assume in your career you've been around guns. When a clip goes empty, the chamber holds open, right?
I have no idea. Do you know how many times I've fired a gun in the military? Like three times when I've had to qualify. Okay. So,
well, I know with pistols, not every pistol, but a lot of pistols, and it shows it in the movie. Orange empties his clip, and the chamber now stays open, indicating that the clip is empty. The magazine is empty, okay? And, you know, John's like, well, he could have reloaded it. I'm like, well, he is a cop. It would be fairly logical for him to reload it, but we never see it. All of that is a moot point as soon as I see the second before Orange is shot, he's actually got both of his hands up in a defensive position. No gun in sight. Orange did not shoot Eddie. So it leaves the only real possibility of being White that shoots Eddie, but there is no clear time for that to happen. And if you watch slow motion, he would have to move his arm from right to left, you know, like 30 degrees. It would be a very obvious movement. He does not do that.
So Chris Penn was interviewed. Do you want to hear the real answer?
So you know the answer. That's the answer.
Oh, that's the answer, the Chris Penn answer?
I read the same thing, so okay. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, so Chris Penn was supposed to get shot by White as White's falling down, but Chris Penn's squib went off early, like all their squibs went off simultaneously, and so instead of like, I guess he just went with it and fell down. Like
he did, and Tarantino basically made the decision to leave it in because it would create controversy. And I was talking with Hannah about this after you logged off last night, Mad Beard, and I'm like, that's just lazy directing.
right. I don't like that kind of decision. So, okay, watching it, I dismissed one of your theories last night, but me watching it just today, I'm like, okay, I think this makes a lot more sense that White kills Joe, but he doesn't have time to kill Nice Guy Eddie, but I'm a little bit more for Pink from Under the Ramp shooting nice guy Eddie, because like at this point Pink is like, I can't believe I'm still here, I can't believe they're arguing, they're obviously going to kill each other.
He's the one that hid the jewels
and
already,
he knows
right?
where the jewels are. He's like, if I kill nice guy Eddie, I can be the one to get away. And so I kind of like that.
Yeah, and that's the one I proposed to John last night.
I just missed it last night, but I'm more watching it. I'm like, I think that could probably be
ballistically.
Yeah.
I had to discount it because of the way Eddie was shot was straight on from where White would be standing. If you want to get technical about it,
right?
Pink would not have had the angle to shoot. But Chris Penn laid all that to rest. He says it was scripted that White would shoot him as he was falling. It was in the script. And I can only assume Tarantino, you know, first movie has so much of a budget for squibs, and he ran out of squibs. And he's like, well, got what we got.
Yeah.
So all of that controversy that I've been hearing since 91, turns out wasn't a controversy at all. It was just lazy editing.
Was this so? It was on, and it was on Chris Penn's deathbed. That's like his final confession.
That was a question I wrote down. Where the crap is Chris Penn?
He died.
Did he really?
Yeah, no, he did die. He died like 10 years ago, I think. I'm trying to remember.
Okay, well now I feel bad.
He had.
I just assume he got overweight and got kicked out of Hollywood. Yeah.
If you ask me. Chris Penn, greater than sign Sean Penn, if you ask me.
So he was only 41 years old when he died. That's really young.
What did he die from? That's interesting.
Like just heart disease, I think.
He fell.
Toxicology reporter, exam revealed heart disease.
Well, he fell on the ground and his heart landed on a bullet.
Well, it says he was reported, noted the prescription drug promethazine with codeine and an enlarged heart were possible contributing factors in his death.
Gosh, dang it. We're
Valium,
still dealing
morphine,
with those
marijuana, and an elevated level of codeine were found in his bloodstream. So it's kind of like Jim Morrison, you know, he died of a heart attack. Yeah, sure.
Okay, so let me talk about this. So this is Quentin Tarantino's first film, which I assume is why the ear getting cut off was off screen. Right, because as soon as that started, I'm like, oh gosh, Tarantino's going to make me watch this guy get his ear cut off. And then they just politely pan the camera away, right?
Tarantino, he kind of evolved. Okay, because I actually listened to the rewatchables of Reservoir Dogs. They talk about this a little bit, but he was strangely reserved in like visual violence. Like famously on Siskel and Ebert, they talk about this in Pulp Fiction about how when Bruce Willis takes the samurai sword and slashes the guy in the chest, like, it's the guy's back that we see, and we see him cut, so you don't see the cut happen. And then when he stabs him again, the stab is kind of, like, off-screen. It's like the camera cuts it off, because it's, like, at the bottom of the screen, so it's below the screen when he stabs him. And he did that a lot in his first movies. Eventually, he, like, in Inglourious Basterds, they talk about this, like, you know, all of Hitler just explodes in a big blood sausage thing.
Yeah.
So I feel like he kind of changes his ways with violence.
Well, I feel like it didn't really start. I was going to say, I feel like it didn't really start until Kill Bill. Like, he always had the violence, but the visuals didn't start. I remember first watching Kill Bill and the visuals being so shockingly there that, like, it was almost comedic, you know?
Yeah.
I might have laughed out loud in the theater just like how gory it got.
And I think that's kind of what he's thinking. He wanted this to be kind of more serious than something schlocky that it's like, oh, he didn't want people to see the effect. He wanted people to see the violence, but not the effect kind of thing.
And then, so I mean, then you can, like, the violence can be left to your imagination, I guess. Yeah. But also I wonder, is it significantly cheaper for it to happen off screen?
It was probably necessity too.
I
probably
remember reading Ebert's review of Kill Bill, right? And basically it was, since this movie didn't get NC-17 for violence, no movie ever will.
Well, and I feel like that's Tarantino. I think it's evident in his movies as he is progressed along pushing that envelope as far as he could. I think in 1991, I don't think he could have done what he did with Inglourious Basterds and gotten away with it. I think the rating systems have changed. I think audiences' appetites for those things have changed. And so I don't think he ever had a plan for showing that. Personally, that's just my own opinion, but I don't think he had a plan to show that in this movie.
So let me ask, because was it Blue Velvet? Blue Velvet came before this film, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Blue Velvet has that famous scene where the guy gets his ear torn off?
Does he? Was that on camera? Or I remember Kyle MacLachlan finding an ear, and which was weird. Did they show the guy's ear getting cut off on camera in Blue Velvet?
So I haven't seen it. I've just read about it. That's like the infamous scene where the guy gets his ear taken off, and that it's really gruesome. So I assume that it is shown.
I did not like Blue Velvet.
Okay, so but I did think it was pretty funny when Mr. Blonde picked up the ear and spoke to it. I thought that was pretty funny.
Can you hear me? Yeah.
I mean, there's probably a difference between having an ear. And I don't remember in Blue Velvet. Was it ripped off? Like
I think it was ripped off. Is what I've read.
There's a difference between being ripped off and then being cut off, right? Like that's a much more. I mean, certainly both are intentional, but one has a different intent to it.
Oh.
So I was a little surprised when they actually showed the cutoff ear. Not the ear on the ground, but the hole in the head, right? The wound.
Yeah, yeah.
And when he was pouring the gasoline on him, I kept kind of looking. I'm like, can you see it? Can you couldn't when he was doing that. But a shot or two later when he's sitting there and there it is. I'm like, oh, okay. So that's what it would look like. I think that's just the evolution of Tarantino is he...
So, I've been thinking about Mr. Orange and how he like was still alive an hour and a half into the film, and I think that his body reabsorbed some of the blood on the ground.
It's possible.
So it just sucked it back into the vein.
We'll get to that.
So what's about the what is the significance of the bathroom story? Like, why is that such an important part of the film?
I think it's Tarantino just talking about how important stories are. It's like, this is what I'm getting into. And if you want someone to believe that you're serious about what you do, then that's what you do. You tell a story the same way I'm telling a story. And I think my favorite thing about the bathroom story is, like, he's like, okay, memorize this story so you can tell these guys, and if they believe the story, they'll believe you. And when he's telling the story, a big part of the story is that the cops he runs into, they're also telling a story to each other.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, and it's like, you know, one of the famous Tarantino things, it's like story within story within story, that it's like, okay, this is what makes it real, the fact that these people are telling stories to each other.
I would say like 2 years ago, I'd probably only seen like a couple of Tarantino films, and I think maybe now I'm getting close to half.
What's missing?
Right. So I've seen both Kill Bills. I haven't seen all of Grindhouse, but I saw Death Proof. I saw Inglourious Basterds.
That's all you need to see because he didn't do the other one.
He didn't do the other one.
Okay. Well, Death Proof, man, that was so good. Of course, I saw Inglourious Basterds, and I saw Pulp Fiction. I think that might be it. Now, is From Dusk Till Dawn considered a Tarantino film, or does he just happen to be in it?
No, so it's like Grindhouse in the sense that him and Robert Rodriguez worked on it together. But so everything leading up to the vampires is Tarantino. Everything after that is Rodriguez. So he only directed half of it. Same thing with Four Rooms, if you're familiar with that movie. He did 1/4 of that movie.
So I guess what have I not seen? I haven't seen The Hateful Eight. I haven't seen Django Unchained.
Yeah. Both of those have some weaknesses. And you saw Hollywood, right?
I've not seen Hollywood.
Oh, so good.
Yeah. I'm actually reading the novelization right now.
John and I disagree with that, but at least on the ending on that one, but man, that movie's good.
Yeah, yeah. I need to see it again because I kind of... It didn't take very well for me because I'm kind of like when I watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's a lot like Milhouse watching the Poochie episode of Itchy and Scratchy when he goes, "When are they going to get to the fireworks factory?" That was kind of me watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I respect it so much more than I like it, and so I got to watch it again, kind of like in a Jackie Brown kind of way.
Are you disappointed that there will no longer be a Tarantino Star Trek film?
Yeah, I was. I knew it was. It would have been a train wreck. I said this on our Star Trek podcast. It would have been a train wreck. I would have watched 20 times. But yeah, I am disappointed. What's the recent news on it? Like, did it? I mean, we knew it wasn't going to happen. But is it like totally gone?
Yeah, he's not doing it. They've associated another director, but I can't remember who it is.
Oh, well, yeah, so there are going to be future... I wasn't even sure if there were going to be any more Star Trek movies.
I can only assume that
there will always be more.
Yeah. I just can only assume that Tarantino insisted on something that the producers of Star Trek just said, there is no way we are filming that and putting it in a Star Trek film.
I think Tarantino would have been like, okay, I just want to film... I just want just all the best slash fiction, like Kirk Spock slash fiction, and I want to put all of that on camera.
Hmm.
All right. I.e. Kirk and Spock having sex.
Well, I will say this. So this was my first time seeing Reservoir Dogs. Mm-hmm. I have seen every Tarantino movie.
Now.
Without ranking them, I really liked Reservoir Dogs, but it's kind of middle to the bottom for me.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think... I'm kind of the same way. I always get a little bit annoyed when I hear people talk about, like, Reservoir Dogs being the best one. I'm like, it's not the best one.
I
like it, but, you know.
I actually was pleasantly surprised by a few things. One, you know, it's a heist movie. We never see the heist. The heist is not important.
Yeah.
What happens on the heist isn't all that important. It's everything after, obviously, and... So the heist is just kind of that vehicle that gets us to this, to the meat of the story of you know, we've got to find a way out of this problem we've got. So I liked that. So calling it a heist movie, I guess, is not accurate, but it's billed as a heist movie.
Yeah.
And in true Tarantino fashion, I really like that he lets his dialogue control the motion of the movie. I think he just does that so well, just writing dialogue. And if it is just writing dialogue about tipping a waitress, or, you know, writing dialogue about...
Like a virgin.
Like a virgin, yeah. Oh. Or who sold us out, sort of thing. He's just got a way of making it interesting. I do want to come back, well, later on in the podcast, I do want to come back to that bathroom scene, though.
Okay, yeah, it might make your best scene.
It might.
I wanna mention something. I watched the Siskel and Ebert where they talked about Reservoir Dogs. By the way, two thumbs down by Siskel and Ebert on their show. But they were both like, this guy's good. I can't wait to see what he does next. I wanted more out of this particular movie because I think he was going in the right direction. But Ebert said something that I thought was interesting. He said, It shows a lot of behavior, but not a lot of insight. And I've kind of been thinking about that because it's like, I think if that's the case, then I kind of think it's like, okay, this is still more insightful than maybe the other two movies that we watched. But somehow I can kind of see that. It's a little bit more about, I guess there's like a lot of external action. You know, these are people like exclaiming things but not taking a moment to think to themselves, or perhaps passing out because of loss of blood rather than talking for 5 minutes. I think that's one thing they said. It's like, mm-hmm. Okay, these people should be passing out rather than talking for,
so,
you know.
That puts them in the minority. This was a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. And a big fan favorite on IMDb. It's an 8.3.
That's really big.
But oddly, so this movie was $1.2 million for the budget, and it cost $2.9 million to make. I guess the budget was so low that everyone was wearing their own clothes from home. Like, people brought their clothes from home, right?
Yeah. I think Michael Madsen had, that was his car.
Yeah. So we didn't get to it, but 81% for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So that was an actually pretty highly rated film. and they made $30 million. They went from 10 to 40 million.
Big hits. Yeah. Big hits.
Nice.
Bill and Ted.
I will say, to kind of Siskel and Ebert's point there, John, is I did enjoy seeing the elements of Tarantino that he's carried throughout his career, and so kind of see the genesis of that was kind of fun to see. Mm-hmm. But it was hard for me to watch this one because it's, I mean, obviously his least polished film. A lot of sound issues were very noticeable, but I'll forgive him. Except he had $2.9 million. You can't do that part right? Come on.
Get a sound guy, yeah. It is, I mean, I think one of the most pleasurable things about watching Reservoir Dogs is seeing the shoddiness of it, you know, considering just how, you know, perfectionist, like, all the ones that after this, you know? It's like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, just seeing just a few little mistakes that kind of make it a little... It kind of makes it seem a little bit more human, in a way.
Well, and I think that's what is kind of fun about this, thinking at it from, like, yours and I's experience, mm-hmm. of making films, is, you know, I can't make Once Upon a Time in Hollywood... I could probably make Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, that's a fun one. Yeah, when you watch it, you're like, oh man, like, why didn't I do this? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Cool.
Well, so Scott, you picked this movie because you own it, but had never seen it before.
Yeah, I've had this in cellophane wrapping and a DVD on my DVD shelf for 20 years, probably.
So no longer mint.
No longer mint. Actually, I cheated. It's still mint. I it was on HBO. So.
Okay. Oh, so you didn't take the wrapping off?
I didn't. I couldn't at this point.
That's funny.
I'm gonna sell this to Graywell Video in 50 years and get like. $2.50 for it. It's gonna be awesome.
Yeah, no, you'll probably get some like yuan or something, like. Okay, it's funny because you talked about watching the scene in slow motion. I guess because you can't really watch in slow motion on. Because I thought, oh, what a shame! You took the cellophane off of the so you could watch it in slow motion, even though it's on HBO. But how did you watch the end scene in slow motion?
Just on HBO. Just
really?
You just tap the. Yeah, just tap the play button over and over again, and I mean it moves several frames at a time, but you get the gist of it. So, it was enough to see A, Orange's hands are empty, and B, White clearly does not move his arm. But it happens so fast. You clearly hear four gunshots. So, it kind of fun to revisit that because I remember being part of arguments, even though I'd never seen the movie, about that. And so, kind of interesting that, again, 20 years to 30 years later, it was one big ruse, and I didn't know it.
That's funny. Well, I'm sure you still won all those arguments, though.
I tried.
Okay, is that it?
That's
all
I got.
More in the... Anymore
well,
in the
I didn't bother looking up, but why Reservoir Dogs? What's with the name?
Oh gosh, there are lots of stories about this.
Is there really?
Yeah, it's one of them.
Because to me, it doesn't make sense.
The one story I remember is that when Tarantino, it doesn't make sense. None of the stories make sense, and I think that's one of the points is he wanted the title that doesn't make sense. But when Tarantino was working at the video store. And he recommended this French film, La Enfance. What's it called? La Enfance something.
Yeah.
And the person, like, there's a guy there with his girlfriend or something, and the guy said, "I ain't watching no Reservoir Dogs." And it's just something that guy said, and he thought that was a cool name, and so he just remembered it. I think that's one of the stories. And then there's one other story that contradicts that story. But I can't remember what that story is.
A bunch. So one is that Reservoir Dog actually refers to a snitch to the cops, being that like rats that live around reservoirs are so big that they look like dogs. So another is that He saw a pile of unsolicited scripts under, like in a bin, and the bin said Reservoir Dogs, I guess. A bunch of scripts fighting for attention and for to get produced, right? So those are a couple of the theories that
so
I saw.
So we just don't really know.
Okay. We don't know.
Yeah. But it works well. It's just kind of like a feeling. It's like, yeah, I don't know what Reservoir Dogs means, but these guys, they are Reservoir Dogs. You know?
Yeah. I can see some of that. I am excited, though, for Reservation Dogs. I don't know if you guys have seen any previews for that.
I accidentally typed it into IMDb several times.
Did you?
Yes. Like, no, not Reservation Dogs. I'm looking up something else.
I mean, you know my love of Taika Waititi, but I think it looks great regardless.
That's the Taika Waititi?
Yes.
I didn't even know. I just thought it was I thought it was, like, Transmorphers. Or something.
No, it's Taika. Yep, FX on Hulu, so it'll be out August, I believe.
A Transmorphers remake of Reservoir Dogs. Oh, man.
Well, good. I'm glad I got to scratch that movie off my list. I've watched many of the Tarantino movies multiple times. I may not revisit this one for a while, but I'll probably get back to it eventually.
Mm. I've been really in the mood to watch Jackie Brown again because I fell asleep
the
first time.
Oh, there you go. There's another one I haven't seen.
Yeah, I figured you hadn't seen it, and I really want JR. I really want you to watch Jackie Brown too because I would say, it is the most different one.
Is it as good as Sugar Hill?
It's like Sugar Hill. Yeah, it's like Sugar Hill.
Okay, the last movie is Shaun of the Dead. Did you know that it cost £4 million to make and it made $30 million? And I don't know the math. I think
that's only 11 pounds.
Yeah, they had only So anyway, Scott, you picked this one because it's meaningful. So you could. I'll let you. This is all you. So
this is all me.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I picked this one. As I stated. This was the movie that kind of brought me and my wife together, which turns out to be a farce. She lied to me. I'm a huge fan of horror movies, and this was one of the very first movies we... In fact, I think it was the first movie we watched together. And we bonded over it, and she told me how much she loved horror movies. And while we were dating, I kept taking her horror movies, and then we got married, and she's like, I hate horror movies. So... she gets scared too easily, and that should have actually I should have understood that because Shaun of the Dead scares her.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I don't find it to be a scary movie at all.
No, it's not really a scary movie.
No. So I get to do the plot synopsis here. Is that how this works?
Yep.
Yes, okay. Sir.
So, Shaun, the movie opens up, I think, brilliantly. With Shaun talking with his girlfriend Liz, and we get to know a lot about Shaun in these first few minutes. Shaun is an appliance salesman who's really got not much going on in his life. He's got a hottie for a girlfriend, but he's worked himself into a rut where he doesn't do anything. They end up at his favorite place every night, which doesn't have food. It's just a pub called the Winchester. And in this conversation, we get to learn a little bit about, you know, his best friend, Ed, who is just off screen. And it's kind of one of my favorite moments is how the movie starts, you know, and a lot of other TV shows and movies have kind of popularized this lately. But they'll be talking about someone and saying something really mean, and then it'll pan out, and that person is sitting right there.
Yeah.
That starts with Ed, and Ed is wonderful. But we learn that Liz and Shaun's relationship is really kind of in trouble because of Shaun's habits towards his friend Ed and toward his job as an appliance salesman and towards his relationship with his stepfather. So he's kind of stuck in this rut, and she's begging him to get out of that rut. So his world is kind of crashing around him, and the beautiful part about this is the rest of the world is crashing around him at the same time, but he is oblivious to it. He doesn't know what's going on. So that leads on to the next day where we get to the opening credits, right? That come right after that, and that kind of brings a lot of those same same ideas into play, where there's a whole lot of clips of people kind of going about their mundane lives in very spoiler alert, zombie-like fashion, and there's a lot of newspaper clippings and stuff like that, news reels of things going on around the world that you just get little clips of. The next day, though, Sean is supposed to schedule a dinner outside of the Winchester with Liz, and he, of course, forgets to do that, and Liz breaks up with him. And then the next morning, he wakes up to a zombie apocalypse. From this point forward, it's really all about survival. And Sean, he's at this point, actually, the night before, he made a promise to himself that he was going to get his act together. And so that next day, you know, it's all about getting his relationship back with his girlfriend, saving his mom, saving his friends, and kind of trying to become a hero that he's never been before. And hilarity ensues, really, in many different forms from that point forward, as they start out traveling by car to try and avoid the zombie apocalypse, and because Ed is just the best, that keeps getting ruined to a point where they end up on foot. Everything boils down to them ending up back at the Winchester, much to Liz's dismay, where they're trying to hold themselves up in the Winchester as long as possible until the Royal Army, whatever they want to call them, the British Army, shows up to kind of save them last minute. So I skipped over a whole lot of stuff there, but
fair. But it's, I mean, he ultimately pulls through, because the movie's about him being nervous about leaving his friends and leaving his parents and actually standing up and growing up. Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's got, you know, like I said, he's got little pockets of his life that are pulling him in all sorts of different directions. He's got his mom, who, you know, she wants him to grow up, and her and Liz have never met, but he's also got this relationship with his stepfather, who, you know, that's a kind of another ongoing joke about a parental ongoing joke. He's not my dad, you know, constantly reminding people that he's not my dad, he's my stepdad. And then his relationship with Liz is being pulled in all those different directions. His relationship with his flatmates, as they would call him, with what was his name, Pete,
Darth Maul.
There's Darth Maul.
He's the voice of Darth Maul. He's not.
Is he really?
Yeah,
of
Darth Maul. Yeah.
There's lots of comments from Pete about that are, I think, are very telling about Sean's overall obliviousness. You know, he says they're talking about something they did was really fun, and he says, "Yeah, that was 5 years ago."
Yeah.
So Pete wants him to grow up and shape up. Yes, yeah, so everything is pulling Sean out of his comfort zone. And I think the obvious, you know, the obvious connection to the zombies is how all that ties together. But
so I love how Ed, when he's driving around, he like goes out of his way to hit as many zombies as he can, right?
Yeah, that there was that very particular scene where it was right when Sean's stepdad dies and becomes a zombie. He says, "Ed, pull over." He says, "Yeah, just a minute." "Ed, pull over." "Yeah, just a second." And it cuts to Ed just pulling the steering wheel hard right and running over a zombie, and then pulling over hard left and then doing a hard tailspin into a stop.
The hockey stops. So then, so when he has the reservation for the restaurant and it's too late for him to get it, I'm a little confused. Like, there's other restaurants, right?
There's one restaurant in town.
Yeah, is that the case? Like, this town has restaurant.
No, it was he let her pick the restaurant, and then he would get the reservation. And so she picked the restaurant. He failed to get the reservation, and that's when he had to tell her. Yeah, I'm sure he could have come up with plan B, but he thinks one way, and that's Ed speaking over his shoulder. Let's go to the Winchester.
Right. Like, it kind of only makes sense if there are only two restaurants. Like, well, I guess Winchester's not a restaurant, right? Right. But
Yeah, they make the point of saying that there's no food at the Winchester.
Yeah.
Except nuts.
But I mean, it's like, it seems like it's the last, he's like, oh, I have to save Winchester now. But I mean, he could have said, I'm sure there's a McDonald's or something. Like, he could have done anything else but the Winchester, but I don't know. But yeah, he only thinks the one way. You're right.
All right. So, having watched this film, for our podcast, we have now covered parts one and part two of the Cornetto series, the Cornetto trilogy.
Cornetto trilogy, correct.
Oh my gosh, we did see Hot Fuzz, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Have you ever had a Cornetto? It looks like a drumstick, but not as much ice cream.
I don't think I have.
I don't think we can get them in the U.S., but John, you would have been around them from time to time.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if they had Cornettos in New Zealand. I feel like that's exactly what they had in New Zealand. That might have been what they had, but I was in London for a day. I should have gotten a Cornetto there, but I don't know. It doesn't look that good, honestly. I mean, it looks like the kind of ice cream I don't like.
It looks like, yeah, most. I'm just looking at a picture. It looks like mostly waffle cone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on the TV, they say, like, the Home Office tells people to stay in their homes, but what's the Home Office? Do you guys know, like, in Britain, what is the Home Office?
I didn't catch that. The Home Office. I'm wondering if it means the health office.
Huh.
I don't know. I've never heard of the Home Office, unless that's just slang for Buckingham Palace or Downing Street, I guess.
Yeah. So let's
talk
about
department. So the Home Office, also known as the Home Department, is a ministerial department of the government of the United Kingdom responsible for immigration, yada yada yada. So it's Parliament, basically.
It's the Immigration Office. Like
immigration security. Yeah. Nah, so responsible for immigration security and law and order. All right. Oh. So it's not just a nickname. It's actually.
It's weird how vague the Brits are. It's certain things. Like, the fact that there's. I still don't understand all the M's. Like, MI6 is James Bond, but MI5 is something else? Is there an MI1, 2, 3, and 4?
So I'm assuming one of those MIs is like their FBI equivalent, right?
Yeah.
Because, like, MI6 is their CIA equivalent.
Right.
So they have an FBI equivalent, which is one of those MIs.
Like, I feel like CIA is, like, somewhere. I think it's, like, a combination of MIs, because there's that show called MI5 that has a lot to do with, like, fighting stuff, and I think MI6 is like the super like, I want to say it's like levels of intelligence, so I'm like, MI1 might be the FBI because it has to do with law enforcement over the whole country, maybe?
And I wonder if Scotland Yard then is their FBI. Phil?
Yeah.
Is Phil on? Where's Phil? We need Phil.
Come in, Phil. Phil, you're there. We're going to talk to him in three...
Next podcast.
In 4 weeks.
Cause... Well, no, he'll come on next podcast to give us his movies.
Oh yeah, hopefully if we can time it.
And then we'll corner him and have him explain the entire MI.
Yeah, like
situation.
We don't get MI. Is it because it was started by M, James Bond's boss?
I have to assume so.
But it's military intelligence is what MI is, right?
Okay.
And so it's like, so maybe the FBI. So Scotland Yard would be different from. Yeah, and that would be the FBI, maybe.
Okay.
Okay.
So let me ask this: is Ed a good friend or a bad friend?
Ed is the best friend.
He's a bad friend.
So
it's just like
he's a bad
his
friend.
His quality
but I love
is
Ed.
Just inconsiderate. That's like he's nice, but he's a good guy. But also, if there's one thing you can say about him, is he's completely inconsiderate.
Yep.
Yeah. No, he really is. Not just inconsiderate, but very. I don't know if selfish is the right word. He just is only concerned about himself. And Sean by some extension.
Yeah.
But I think he's the best friend. He's the type of guy. Nah, I'm kidding. I wouldn't really want to hang out with him.
it would be
pretty exhausting. But watching their relationship is what makes this movie work so well for me. They established that relationship very early on, right in that first scene in the bar. And the thing that I love about it is no matter what happens, no matter how high the stakes get throughout the coming days, their relationship doesn't change, right?
Yeah.
Down to the point, one of my favorite moments is in the Winchester at the end, and when they're arguing with David, and David says something about him being his boyfriend. He says, "He's not my boyfriend." And Ed chimes in right then with a glass of frosty beverage, and he says, "It might be a bit warm. Cooler's out." And Sean just says, "Thanks, babe."
Thanks, babe. Yeah.
Well, like, so a couple minutes after that, Ed turns on the jukebox, right?
Yes.
So.
Yeah, and he's a guy who would turn. It's a zombie invasion. He doesn't really ever seem super concerned. I don't know if he's, like, living in the real world, but it's a zombie invasion. He turns on the jukebox, and also when they're struggling to get into the Winchester pretending to be zombies, he's the one who takes a call. And you gotta wonder, like, who's on the other line who's just chatting Ed up about what's going on? I get some major, like, Joe Evans vibes, like, with that sequence.
Yeah.
Like, I imagine, Steele, can you imagine if we're hanging out with Joe, like, at the end of the world, and Joe just takes a call from somebody, and, like, who else 100%. Is not concerned like Joe is not concerned, yeah.
Yep. But that's what works about Ed in this context. Like I said, maybe he wouldn't be my best friend, but he's wonderfully fit for this movie.
Yeah.
I think he's a great friend for certain circumstances. So I think, like, after Sean breaks up with Liz, and it's funny because who's the roommate that, like, comes in and says, "What's going on?" And he says, "We broke up with Liz."
That was Pete.
Yeah, Pete. So we, does that mean, like, is Ed part of that equation? We broke up. But, like, him and Ed, they're just doing, like, they're just doing home DJ electro music. And, like, that's a good time to have a friend like Ed, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Ed is easily my favorite part of the movie, though. Everything he does is glorious. When they're talking about getting into the Winchester, and they come up with a plan to act like zombies, and they're going down the line, and each one, "Give me your best zombie," and they get to Ed, and he says, "I'll do it on the night." It is the night.
Yeah, I suppose I would hate to have a friend like Ed in a lot of ways, but also if I knew Ed, life would suck if I weren't his friend, you know? Like, if he didn't like me, it would suck more. If he were in my life, I'd be sad if he weren't my friend, I guess.
And see, Ed is interesting in the way that This can be a good thing or a bad thing, but it also can be a good thing, is that he's not really afraid, even though he's oblivious like Sean, and he's self-centered in a lot of ways. But when it comes down to it, and when it's probably the most important, he's not afraid to tell you like it is. And I wish I had that quote up, but when he was talking to Sean about Liz after she broke up with him, and they're back at the Winchester, of course, getting drunk. This is the same night that they go home and anger Pete. But he says a line about, "I'm not going to tell you about there's other fish in the sea," but his conclusion is basically just, you know, forget about it, but in an Ed way. And I think at that moment, Sean, as devastated as he is, it was kind of the moment that there was kind of a realization to Ed, or to Sean, even though Ed was trying to tell him the opposite thing, it was kind of that moment where Sean went, "Oh, you know what? I gotta take this more seriously." So, in a roundabout way, Ed is responsible for pushing Sean that extra distance.
Okay. So, it's interesting you talked about this being like a horror film as far as the deal with you and your wife, because we usually in October we usually do like three podcasts, and I've kind of been waiting for like horror comedy to come up, and I thought, well, Shaun of the Dead would probably fit into that, but like there's not a single moment in this film that I think is scary, and I don't know how to call this a horror film other than the zombies exist in this film.
Yeah, and that's a conversation I've had with John. I've had with a cousin of mine who's kind of equally involved with horror films, is I used to define horror films, a good horror films, on whether or not it scared me.
Yeah.
And I kind of had to take a step back and recognize that horror films exist in a much broader world than that, and does it have horror elements? And that's how I've tended to view things lately is, does it have horror elements? I think Shaun of the Dead is much more than just having horror elements. I think, you know, it's classically defined because of zombies.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's certainly not a scary movie.
It's certainly, you know, I mean, I don't necessarily find it scary, you know, because I'm a man and I would never admit that I was scared by Shaun of the Dead, like, live on a podcast or anything. But, I mean, but it's definitely a good zombie movie. Like, they don't cut corners on the genre. Like, it's well within the genre. And, I mean, it is a comedy, so therefore it's not as scary. I mean, if nothing else, you know, it alleviates the focus is on the relationship, and the zombie stuff is kind of in the background, but that doesn't mean they cut corners on the zombies. So, respect.
So it's interesting. And so maybe the greatest horror comedy of all time, it could be Abbott and Costello Meets Frankenstein. And there's nothing really scary about that film either. So it's interesting. Now, but this film right here, where it, like, historically, we kind of had like a zombie apocalypse of movies for a number of years, right? Mm. So where was this movie? Was this on the crest? Was this when zombie movies were still, like, rising?
I think it was towards the beginning, it feels like, but...
Kind of ignited, I would say.
This came out the same year
as Dawn of the Dead. Like, they were right next to each other. Like, the remake of Dawn of the Dead, the Zack Snyder remake of Dawn of the Dead and Shaun of the Dead came out the same year. And I think zombies were... It was kind of a throwback thing then, but it's weird. Ever since Shaun of the Dead, I would say that's when 95% of all zombie movies happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I agree. I think it was towards the beginning. I'd have to go back and look, but that feels about right to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I still hold on to the hope that we'll do horror comedies because I'm dying to do Dale and Tucker.
Oh, see, and have you ever seen that one?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. I think there's some really, really good entries into that genre. And it depends how you define comedy as well, because, like, I know you guys watched Dead Snow at one point.
I love Dead Snow.
To me, that's a horror comedy, you know. Yeah. There's some really bad ones, but that's true for all horror movies. There's some great and some bad, and it's a genre I'm a big fan of in general.
Yeah. Well, there's a 2% chance that I'm going to make us watch Dead Snow 2 here in about an hour.
Nice. 2% chance. Yeah. Okay.
There's a 2% chance.
I do love Dead Snow 2 as well.
Two things really quick. I want to go back to, like, where this counts in the wave of zombie movies.
Yeah.
First thing, this movie came out in 2004, I think.
2004.
And in 2007, Scott, we made a zombie movie.
Yes, we did.
Is that 2007? I'm trying to get the year right.
2007. It was 2007, 2000. No, it had to have been later than that. Because Jamie and I started dating in 2008.
It must have been 2009.
Yeah, I think it had to have been 2008, 2009-ish. Okay.
So I think...
Because Jamie was in it, and we would have been dating at the time, because we didn't hang out before then, so... So we started dating 2008, so it was after that.
Okay.
And I know where you're going with this. Go on.
Well, actually, no, do you, okay.
Well, I assume you're just talking about, so I came to John with this movie idea.
Yeah.
Zombies were on my mind, because zombies were all around, and as I just mentioned, I just met my future wife, and we bonded over this movie. So I had this idea for a zombie movie. John came up with the name for the movie, though.
Yes.
And the name of the movie is called The Last Zombie Movie Ever.
Yeah.
Because John thought...
Silly.
We were
silly
the
me.
End of the zombie wave.
I'm like, we're not going to... There will be no zombie movies after this. Yes. No, that's exactly where I was going. Yeah, and so that's kind of why I think, Shaun of the Dead is the beginning, because... 5 years later, I'm like, this is definitely the no more zombie movies. No more. Yeah.
Everyone should go watch the last zombie movie ever.
Yeah.
So 2 years before Shaun of the Dead was 28 Days Later, which is also a British zombie.
And, and that very much was, the beginning of the zombie wave. So I think that...
Fair enough. I just want to find, because I think I found the quote you were looking for, Scott. Ed says, "See, you don't need Liz to have a good time." And Sean says, "Oh, don't, man." And then Ed says, "No, go ahead, look at me. Can I just say one more thing? I'm not going to say, you know, there's plenty more fish in the sea. I'm not going to say, if you love her, let her go. And I'm not going to bombard you with cliches. But what I say is this. But what I say is this?" Question mark, chuckling. "It's not the end of the world." That was the thing I said.
And so, such, man, I love Edgar Wright. I just love him.
Yeah.
So many visual and audio clues, right? And how they tie into the dialogue in that specific moment when the hand slaps up against the window. Yep. Anyways.
Yeah.
So Shaun of the Dead, 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
In fact, that is our, well, okay, Reservoir Dogs is also 92%.
92%, yo.
Only 7.9 on IMDb, though, which is lower than...
Yeah.
What was the other one? Said
Reservoir
was 8
Dogs. Reservoir
like,
Dogs
yeah.
is 84.
Tarantino owns IMDb. I guess that's
he does.
Yeah.
Higher than Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which is a 7.0.
Okay. All high. All respectably
yeah.
high.
Yeah.
So, like, every time we podcast, I keep wondering, should I throw Metacritic in here as well? But then I get tired thinking about that.
Metacritic's annoying to use.
Yeah. It kind of is, yeah.
All right. Are you guys ready for some awards?
Finally.
Yes.
Okay, so we're doing them in Roy order. So, John, you might have to jump around a little bit. But I'll start with you, Scott. Your favorite title of these three films?
That's tough for me because it's really kind of a toss-up between Shaun of the Dead, which is a wonderful play on movie title words, and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but I go with Bill and Ted's just because it tells you exactly what to expect.
Very good. John, what about you?
I went with the other one, Reservoir Dogs, the one that wasn't even in contention. I think because it sells a vibe more than a... Yeah, it sells a vibe. It's a vibe, Reservoir Dogs.
As I mentioned 10 minutes ago, I didn't even know what that meant, so I couldn't pick it.
Right. Well, that's why I like it, because I don't know what it means. I think, yeah, I would say that.
I just want the movie title to tell me what I'm getting into.
I don't want any spoilers in my title.
So okay. If you're going to eat a lemon cake, you want a little bit of yellow on top of the frosting, huh?
Yes.
Some exactly. shavings or something, huh?
Exactly.
Okay, well, so I'm happy to represent the third film. I picked Shaun of the Dead, so there we go. Your favorite movie poster, John?
Okay, well, we're going to go Reservoir Dogs here. We got the two. It's like everybody from, like, it's like they made the Specials logo with the two-tone guy in the hat come to life, and, like, everybody from the Specials, like the ska movement, is on the cover of Reservoir Dogs because they're walking in their suit and it's kind of got the tan thing and they got the sunglasses. Icon.
Very good. What about you, Scott?
I'm sticking with Shaun of the Dead.
I went with Reservoir Dogs on this one. I thought it was pretty sharp.
I do think it's the sharpest looking of the three, but I don't know. I like a good cricket bat.
Okay, Scott, your favorite tagline from these three films?
These are the ones specifically on the posters, right?
Yep.
Bill and Ted's. History is about to be written by two guys who can't spell.
That's good.
What did you pick, John?
I picked, this one's long, I picked five total strangers team up for the perfect crime. They don't know each other's name, but they've got each other's number. It should just say, they don't know each other's names, but they've got each other's number. But, yeah, whatever.
Well, yeah, especially because it wasn't a perfect crime.
Right, yeah.
It was a far from perfect
crime. Yeah, it was the last thing. Yeah, so it's got flaws, but I kind of like how it ends. It wraps up. Good wrapping up tagline. Yeah, it's a paragraph, but whatever. It wraps up well.
So I'm going to throw my vote in with Scott. I like the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure tagline. And here's where we give them far better taglines than they gave themselves. So we'll start with John. You just do all three of your films.
All right. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Our future depends on their history grade.
That's good.
Okay. Reservoir Dogs tagline. Worst P-Day ever. The Shaun of the Dead tagline. First things first, get the girl, then run from the zombies.
Very good. What do you got, Scott?
I'm going to have to plead the fifth on this one because I completely misunderstood the homework assignment on that one. I looked up the actual alternate taglines and was looking at those. So if you're interested in those, I can read some of them.
I'm interested.
Sure.
Oh, where did I write those? I'll just tell you the ones I thought were the best. Let's see. Tagline, alternate tagline. Okay, so for Excellent Adventure, they're not that good. Brace Yourself, Amigos. This was actually on the VHS cover. Brace Yourself, Amigos, for a most triumphant video. Shaun of the Dead, Buy Milk, Ring Mum, Dodge Zombies. I actually think that's great.
That is good.
and then Reservoir Dogs. The one that actually ties almost very closely to the original one, except it ends, but they've got each other's color. I thought that was a nice little change.
Okay. So for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, I have How Waterloo Got Its Name. And for Reservoir Dogs, I put None Shall Stand, All Shall Fall. And Shaun of the Dead, the UK is about to get a bit bitey.
Ah, oh, nice.
That does bring up a question. Which came first, the water park or the name?
Yeah,
is it named because...
It's a crazy pretzel. Who knows?
Yeah.
It's just a coincidence. They're like, this is a big place with water, and everybody uses it for a toilet, so they call it Waterloo.
Okay.
It wasn't because Napoleon went back in time with that name in mind. All right.
Like, now we're at this battlefield, and I dub it Waterloo. Okay, so best opening credits, Scott.
I got to think about them again. I'm going with Shaun of the Dead.
Okay. It's really solid credits. John, what have you got?
Okay, I want to point out, I wrote down Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, I think because the Big Pig song is so great, and also I don't know what that big, like, dome, copper dome thing is, but we have to point out that that the other two movies also open with great songs. You got Ghost Town by the Specials for Shaun of the Dead, and Little Green Bag in Reservoir Dogs, which is really great. I'm not picking it for my best song, but it's, you know, it's the song, what is it? It's the song that goes, looking back in the track for a little green bag, gotta find just the kind of thing I'm losing my mind. Anyway, great song. So, they all open great, so... Good credits.
And your favorite opening credits?
Yeah, you didn't actually say.
Oh, I said Bill and Ted's. I just went with Bill and Ted's because it's...
Well, you said you were... Yeah, anyways.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I'll just... Yeah. Bill and Ted's. Yeah, sure.
So one of the Bill and Ted's movies mentions that the future has a lot of domes. That, like, that's a distinguishing feature of the future. There's lots of domes. So let's see. For my best opening credits, I also picked Bill and Ted's because... Breakaway may be the greatest song that I only listen to once every 10 years. So, all right, your favorite technology, John.
Okay, well, it has to be the phone booth. It's probably the best time travel instrument we've seen so far because you don't even need to use it to get stuff done.
There you go. What about you, Scott?
And it's multifunctional. I tried to find tech in the other movies, and there's just not. So, yeah, it's the phone booth.
Okay. So I have an honorable mention, which is a tape recorder with a timer, because I'm not sure that exists. Because, like, they planted that tape recorder with a timer, right?
Oh, yeah. Good thought.
Yeah, they had the timer. And they would have had – I mean, as dumb as they are, they would have had to have been geniuses to work the tape recorder with the timer. But then they also record themselves continuing on with the charade on the tape itself.
So, but what I chose was from Shaun of the Dead, they used records like Ninja Stars. So Ninja
Stars. Yes. Yes.
I'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah,
I might also get to that.
Okay. All right, your favorite name, John.
Okay, two honorable mentions, sorry. First, Ted Theodore Logan, like we talked about, because he doesn't know how to put nicknames in quotes. And then Mr. Orange, his real name is Freddie Neuwendijk, which is a cool name. But the best name is just Wild Stallions, because it has the rock and Y's instead of I's.
Nice.
All right, Scott.
My honorable mentions, we've actually already mentioned. Dave Beethoven, Maxine of Arc, Herman the Kid, Bob Genghis Khan, Socrates Johnson, that might be my favorite of those, Dennis Froude, and of course Abraham Lincoln. But I'm actually going with Mr. Pink strictly because of the conversation that comes about by giving Steve Buscemi the name Mr. Pink.
Yeah. Yeah. Good meta commentary about the our best name award. I want to throw in one of the other honorable mentions is when Ted, he's looking at the board behind the history teacher's name. He's like, oh no, thanks to Joan of Arc, Genghis Khan, yes. And Socratic Method.
The Socratic Method.
The world is full of his. I think he says the world is full of history.
Yeah.
So I picked Missy. I just went with Missy. I think it's a great name. So
a little boring. Okay.
Thank you. So what's your favorite food then, Scott?
So I don't know if you guys noticed, but there's only food in one of these movies. Really. But the Ziggy Pig.
I also selected the Ziggy Pig.
I thought about it. It looked gross. With it all over his face, I didn't go with the Ziggy Pig. I went with... And there's food in Reservoir Dogs. The particular food I'm picking, we don't see it on screen, but they are mentioned. But fries from Kahuna Burger Mr. Blonde ate in the car already.
Ah, very good. Okay, so John, then what's your favorite outfit?
You got to go with the matching black suits in Reservoir Dogs.
So I was tempted. I almost did. What have you got, Scott?
I actually went with the black suits from Reservoir Dog. But my honorable mention would be Sean's white shirt with the red ink splotch.
You got red on you, yeah.
Yep.
So I went with Napoleon's one-piece see-through swimwear.
That's excellent, actually. I hadn't considered that.
That's good.
All right, the best alien, Scott.
I couldn't think of any alien.
Well, this is where we like to get racist, but I'm going to go ahead and go with Genghis Khan, who's definitely not a legal immigrant. So,
okay. I thought of maybe going around that path, but I didn't dare. So,
right, yeah, no, good for you. We don't do that. but I'm going to go with Mr. Blue, the guy who likes borderline, but nothing after that, because he is. He's like Edward Bunker. He is just a criminal, like a famous real-life criminal that Tarantino is like, oh, I'm going to get Edward Bunker. Apparently he wrote a book about criminality or something.
Mm.
And so Tarantino just hired him. So he's out of place. I'll just say that.
Mm. And I would probably, going back, choose Rufus because he feels very out of this world. In some senses, he is. He's an alien to our time.
Yeah.
So, Rufus's hair is super slicked back.
Mm. Very slicked back. Yes.
Have you both seen the? I think you should leave now. Is that?
Oh yes, I think you should leave. Something like his hair is like he couldn't get his hair more slicked back. Like back then, I was such a what was it? I was such a
piece of crap.
Such a piece of crap. My hair was so slicked back. I was such a piece of crap. Okay.
Look at this, Grandpa. You can tell he had his hair slicked back. Anyway, yeah. So, all right. Let's see. Best special effects, Scott.
Best special effects is the girl in the garden falling back onto the...
Oh, yeah.
Onto the post.
Oh, and there's a hole through her that we look through.
Yes, yes.
So that scene immediately reminded me of the movie Revenge. Have you guys seen Revenge on Shudder?
No.
Have I?
Oh, that's a crazy movie where like the guy who's having an affair with the model then pushes her off the cliff and she lands.
Yes, I saw that at Sundance. Yeah, I did see that. Yeah, it's a bit crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, very similar scene in that movie.
All right, so Scott, you picked the girl
on the post.
What about you, John?
Okay, I picked David getting ripped apart by zombies and them taking all his intestines out.
Yeah,
that was a good honorable mention for me.
So I'm also on the David Dies bandwagon. Nice. Best location, John.
The utopian future that's governed by the Bruce Springsteen saxophone player.
How about you?
I also chose the future, but did not describe it as such. Very, very monotone future, which is kind of disappointing, except it's my color.
So I went with the pre-heist diner. Seems like a good place to get a meal. Now we're on to the best song, Scott.
Best song is Queen's Don't Stop Me Now.
That's really good. That's a great scene, too.
Great scene.
And yeah, it's all because of the scene.
Yeah.
But I do love the song.
It's a good song. It's in my top 20, or maybe 30 Queen songs. Okay, well, I told you I really liked George Baker, Little Green Bag, but I was almost mad because we finished all these movies and the credits roll on Shaun of the Dead and it's You're My Best Friend by Queen, which is one of my very favorite songs, and I was almost mad because I'm like, oh, well, I have to put You're My Best Friend by Queen because it's one of my very favorites. So, yeah, that's what I went with.
Okay, so I thought for sure I was going to pick Breakaway. Like, as soon as it was the first of the three movies that we watched, and like 30 seconds in, and I'm like, well, here's the best song. But I ended up going with I Gotcha by Joe Tex from Reservoir Dogs.
Oh,
and
wow.
I don't know if you remember it, but it's you should YouTube that. That was a great song.
I Gotcha. No one picked Steeler's Wheel, probably. You know, the famous musical scene is the Steeler's Wheel stuck in the middle with you. No one picked a lot of there were too many good songs with these three movies, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with Tarantino, is you're always going to get a good soundtrack out of him.
Yeah.
All right, your favorite guest, John.
Okay, I went with Jessica Stevenson. She's the one who keeps popping up in Shaun of the Dead. You know, they meet in the street, and then she meets with all her friends, and then she comes back with the military. And she's the best guest because she was the co-star of Spaced, the Edgar Wright, Simon Pegg television show. And so it was just a great way to have her as a guest.
Hey, okay, what have you got, Scott?
Yeah, I struggled with this one. I went with George Carlin, not for any reason other than George Carlin is George Carlin.
Yeah, that's
sure. This is our most ambiguous.
Of all the people in the movie, he's the one that certainly stands out, you know, and feels like he's probably was bigger than Bill and Ted's at the time, but he was still there.
Yeah.
Oh, very good. So in Reservoir Dogs, I went with LAPD officer Martin Nash, who is an unwilling guest of our Reservoir Dog gang.
That's good.
Oh, yes. I like it.
All right, Scott, you're the best Odyssey reference.
You know, I can't even say. I was listening to your podcast with Rhett a little while ago, and you guys got into that big conversation. I'm lost when it comes to the Odyssey, so I did not take that semester like John did.
Okay. Well, John, what do you got?
I just remembered just now. I'm going to go with Officer Nash again. He's an ear cyclops in that he only has one ear.
Okay.
So I'm going with Sean, who's Odysseus, and he returns to Liz, who is Penelope, who is surrounded by suitors, David, as well as the zombies.
Very good. That's
It was intentional.
Right.
Edgar Wright was definitely thinking Odyssey when
he was
did
thinking
that.
Odyssey. We're all thinking Odyssey all the time. That's fair.
Yeah.
Except
all right. External recurring character, go, John.
Okay. External recurring character. The actor who was in a previous movie, well, it's got to be Diane Franklin, the foreign exchange student in Better Off Dead, who was also one of the princesses.
Oh, that is her. That is her, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Monique.
Yeah.
I knew I recognized her, but I've never put that together. That's really embarrassing.
Yeah.
I went with just the obvious. You guys watched Hot Fuzz, my second favorite of the Cornetto trilogy, so you got a couple to choose from there.
Yeah, just the whole
cast.
The Cornetto, you could say Cornetto, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so that is what I did because I thought I could say Nick Frost or what's his face?
Timothy Dalton.
No, I just said Cornettos.
Okay.
Cornettos. Okay. Internal recurring character, and I actually found one. But curious what you guys have. Go ahead and go, Scott.
I stole John's that he gave to me.
What did I give you?
Just people being shot in the face. Not necessarily the face, but people being shot.
That's right, yeah. People getting shot. No, that's fine. I'm pretty sure I chose what Roy chose, which is Kathy Nelson on staff. She's the music supervisor for MCA and Reservoir Dogs, and also the executive in charge of music for Universal Pictures for Shaun of the Dead.
Indeed she is.
Oh, that's a deep cut.
It is deep, yeah. but we have a super secret IMDb search thing that tells you immediately, so that's kind of... So in a way, the internal recurring character is by far the easiest one to do.
Okay. Well, for those of you that have the super secret IMDb search.
Yeah.
So how often would you say that works out for us, though? Like 20% of the time?
Yeah, usually it's like... Because when we first found out about it, we found one every time, but the last like bunch, it's like it's never worked. So just because... And I chalk that up to picking movies that you'd think would go together but don't, which is kind of the badge of honor when we have three movies that where no one worked on the same one, even though there's some kind of connection that we thought of.
Yeah, it was a big shock tonight, but not find any actors that did The Seventh Seal as well as Apocalypse Now or The Hobbit.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so let's see. Your favorite death, Scott?
Favorite death, it's everyone at the end of Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
The Mexican standoff death?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
What do you got,
John? And David.
Yeah, go ahead. And David, yeah. Well, David. My vote's David. So.
Oh, is your vote David? Of course, yeah. Is it, like, is that the guy you wanted to just die the whole time? Is that?
Well,
is
he
that
was why? He was one of them. That and the other guy that works at the store. What's the guy's name? The chubby teen,
Noel?
Like Kevin or Noel? Yeah, Noel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Played by Rafe Spall.
He shows up at the very end. If you caught that,
as a zombie. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So he got his.
Yeah. Well, he went back to work, right?
Like they... Yeah, he was the one that was shown pushing the or collecting the carts at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah, that's him. Okay, I got it. Okay, this is where the vinyl comes back. But I went with the original pressing of Blue Monday that Ed shattered.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yes.
All right. So your my favorite death is David. Just good for David. Yeah. So the best villain, John.
Okay, the woman who got carjacked who shot Mr. Orange.
Oh, very good.
Very she wasn't good. Supposed to shoot him. Can you believe it?
Yeah. What about you, Scott?
My villain was Time.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Time was always against Bill and Ted.
Yeah.
It's always
so I went. Yeah. I went with Blondie. He's probably the scariest villain in any of these films.
He was definitely my runner-up.
All right, Scott, who's your hero?
My hero is Sean. There is none other.
John, what do you got?
Okay, I went with Mr. Orange, not because he shot Mr. Blonde, but because he has a superhero power, and that superhero power is just having 50 gallons of blood in his body.
I think as long as he's in contact with his blood, it still works, right?
Right, right. But like, he's like, why? What good is having 50 gallons of blood? Well, brother, you just found out.
Okay, so I also have Sean, but specifically for saving the Stone Roses record.
Mm. Yes. Oh, the Stone Roses records.
Yeah.
Yeah, you notice that? Because I remembered it wrong, you know. Like, he's the one who's... He's like, well, what about the second Stone Roses record? He's like, I like it. Yeah, so...
Oh, yeah. All right, let's see. Best movie goof, Scott.
I wrote this down because technically it's a goof. The ending of Reservoir Dogs.
Oh yeah, for sure. That, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
What about you, John?
Okay. Okay, sorry. Two honorable mentions. First of all, in Shaun of the Dead, this is a big one. The biggest problem I have with Shaun of the Dead is you can't just pretend to be a zombie and like walk past zombies. Like, they're not looking at... They're not listening for groans. Like, they can tell if you're alive or dead, you know?
But is that a movie goof?
That's a movie goof.
That's just an interpretation.
That's a huge movie goof. My other movie goof is hey, does anybody want to put pressure on the wound of Mr. Orange?
Oh, like, yeah.
Like, just think about putting pressure on the wound at some point in time. Mr. Orange, yeah. You could do it yourself, even.
Yeah, I know. It's like,
yeah, just
well,
once,
and
just
at
once.
One point, Mr. White does the opposite, right? He when he gets him to the warehouse, he lays him down, and he undoes his belt buckle, which is kind of covering the wound.
Oh, yeah, yeah, he shouldn't do that. He's like, oh, I better let this wound breathe. Just air this out. You'll be fine. We're going to get you safe, buddy.
You got to get rid of the bad blood, right? All the blood that's tainted by the bullet got to get out.
Let's just recycle this. Just cycle that out. Cycle it out. It's touching the air. You don't want that. You don't want that near you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. No, but the winner is when they all go at the diner scene when they all pay and they all just throw a crumpled wad of bills. Just a crumpled wad of bills, and Lawrence Tierney like sees the crumpled wad and immediately says, "Hey, someone didn't tip." Like, how does he know? It was just a crumpled wad of bills. Like, there's no way you could possibly know that one person didn't tip. But okay.
So I went with what I thought was supposed to be part of the plot, but it wasn't. So in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, when the phone booth lands at the Circle K, you clearly see the antenna fall off, right? And I thought, okay, well, it's damaged. This is part of the plot. But then when they get back in the phone booth, the antenna's back on top.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah. All right, the funniest moment, your LOL or your LULZ. Go ahead, John.
All right, once more, an honorable mention. But in Shaun of the Dead, when Pete says of Ed, he's an effing idiot. And then Ed says, what's that supposed to mean? but the winner, and it's something I laughed so hard when I saw it the first time, and I laughed again, but it's the keys. It's the keys in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure when they discuss going back in time, and just them discussing it magically puts the keys behind the sign that they're talking at.
Yeah.
All right, what about you, Scott?
We've already mentioned this, but I'm going to read the dialogue for you.
Oh.
Now, some of these are limited. What was that? I think it was Blue Monday. Man, that was an original pressing. Oh, for bleep's sake. Purple Rain? No. Sign of the Times? Definitely not. The Batman soundtrack? Throw it.
Throw it.
Dire Straits? Throw it. Ooh, Stone Roses? No. Second Coming? I like it. Ah, Sade. Yeah, but that's Liz's. Yeah, but she dumped you. Oh. The garden scene. I laugh every time I see that. I think it's so brilliant.
Oh, that's good. So I think my biggest laugh out loud moment was probably when Sean got the dart to his head.
Yeah. Throw it at his head.
That was really good. Okay, your best what the heck moment, Scott.
Again, it's just the ending of Reservoir Dogs. It's one of those moments I wish I didn't know about before I saw it. But even still seeing it, having known it, it was still kind of shocking to me.
What about you, John?
I gotta go with the torture of the cop. Because it's kind of the most famous scene in Reservoir Dogs, but also, gosh, so, like, unnecessary, too.
Yeah. So yeah. You kind of saw it coming, and so I had that, and I just scratched it. And I think, so I replaced it with when Pink gets hit by a car.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess, like, getting hit by a car doesn't hurt as much as you think it would because he just runs off.
It gave him carjacking powers.
Yeah, I guess. He totally got smashed by a car. So that was mine. So best quote. I'm going to go ahead and go first because, some of these might get taken. So I got a couple honorable mentions. We're coming to get you, Barbara. That one's really good.
Oh, yeah.
Strange things are afoot at the Circle K. And this one has already been mentioned. My favorite quote is, thanks to great leaders such as Genghis Khan, Joan of Arc, and Socratic Method.
Oh, sorry, I mentioned that already.
Yeah. All right, Scott, what you got?
The story within the story in Reservoir Dogs, the cops in the bathroom. One of the only audible lines you hear from the cops is he says, buddy, I'm going to shoot you in the face. So you get that with no context. I think it works great.
What do you got, John?
Honorable mention, I just realized this again, it's when White and Pink are talking, and Pink says, did you kill anybody? and White says, "I tagged a couple cops," and then Pink says, "So no real people?" But my favorite line, because I heard it 10 times, and it's a Pink line where he says, "We're supposed to be professionals." And I thought it was just funny. Like, this time I never realized Pink says we're supposed to be professionals like 15 times in the movie. It just made me laugh.
Let me throw out a couple more, just because I've already said Bill and Ted's, it's one of my most quotable movies. Mm. Bill says, they land and they see Socrates, right? And he says, "Socrates." And Ted says, "Hey, look him up." And he pulls up the book. Oh, it's under Socrates. Yeah. But then one of my favorite parts is, so Billy, they've got Billy the Kid, they've got Socrates with them, and they
picking up
they
girls at the mall.
They go land. No, before that, okay. They go land in the medieval times, and Billy's kind of getting everyone integrated, and Bill just says, "Billy, you are dealing with the oddity of time travel with the greatest of ease."
Oh man. So can I tell you, like, from Bill and Ted's, like, there's a line that just drives me crazy, and it's when Abraham Lincoln says, "Party on, dudes."
Yeah.
Party on, dudes.
I just can't handle it.
Lost the character.
I can't handle that, yeah.
It's like Darth Vader screaming no at the end of episode 3.
Yeah. Oh, man. Jeez. So, okay. Best scene, Scott.
All right. Best scene for me is what I call the monologue from Reservoir Dogs, even though it's not a monologue. But it is Mr. Orange's... The scene that we've talked about, we've referenced a couple times about the storytelling, and I love how it transforms from location to location and from audience to audience, right? So it starts out him and his... I assume a cop buddy kind of talking about the idea, to him practicing it in his apartment, to him practicing it in front of his friend, to him now verbalizing that in front of Mr. White and Mr. Pink and the rest. And I love how that whole thing is just put together. And it's Tarantino telling stories again. It's just one of my favorite things.
So I'm thinking about it, like, Holdaway is like the police captain that he reports to, right? The guy's name is Holdaway. Yeah. I think aside from audience inside the diner, Holdaway is the only character that survives this film that we see. Like, I think everyone else dies. And then you have to excuse all the cops that rush into the warehouse at the end, but I think every other primary character dies in this film. Mm-hmm. John, what's your favorite scene?
I have to go with... because they set the scene up earlier. It's the second time Sean does his morning routine where he walks to the shop and all the zombies are in the background, and he goes to the shop and he does his normal thing and he doesn't realize everything is, you know...
It's all familiar, but for different reasons.
Yeah, and he slips on the blood. Like,
he doesn't notice that he slipped on blood. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is my favorite scene in that movie. Mm. I do love that scene.
So I went ahead and picked the Mexican standoff, and I'm going to say when all four of them got shot and fell down, I guess I'm just not as observant as you guys. I was like, huh, okay. And like, so I didn't catch it, but I like the Mexican standoff. So best actor from these three films, John.
It's a tie for me. I wrote down Chris Penn, because I love when his eyes get big at the end and he's yelling. And again, Chris Penn better than Sean Penn. There, I said it.
There you go.
No takebacks. But also, I was thinking about it just now, and it's like, whose movie is Reservoir Dogs? I think it's got to be Steve Buscemi. Like,
yeah.
This has got to be the role of Steve Buscemi in his life. And I think he did great.
So, like, of all the Steve Buscemi films, this feels like the least Steve Buscemi of all the Steve Buscemi films.
Well, he finally kind of gets to be a cool person instead of something.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he does it well.
Yeah. All right, Scott, what do you got?
I've already mentioned, and I'm not going to backtrack, it's Alex Winters. He does it for me.
Yeah.
Oh, very good. Okay.
Bill S. Preston, Esquire.
So I just chose Harvey Keitel as Mr. White. So, unanswered question time. All of mine got answered, and I had to come up with a new one as we were going along. Something we didn't talk about in Reservoir Dogs. How far can you drive a car with a bullet hole in your head?
Right. Okay. Because I wasn't sure if he was bleeding from the bullet hole to his head. Who was I talking? I mentioned this to you last night, Scott. It was like regarding Henry.
Mm-hmm.
Situation where he got shot in the head perfectly so that he only died like 5 minutes later, but I'm not totally sure. Like, you can't get shot in the head and drive.
See, and I misread that whole scene completely, so don't ask me, because I assumed that he hit his head on the steering wheel when he crashed the car. I remember Mr. White saying he saw him get shot, but I did not piece that together that still could have happened before they got in the car to drive away.
And I thought I remembered White specifically saying that he saw him get shot in the head.
He did say that. He said that very specifically. And that's why I was confused, and I was talking to John about this last night, was that car crash scene, there is gunshots, but it's all Mr. White's shots. The police come around the corner, and Mr. White opens up. Mr. White? Yeah, how about that? I just put that connection together. He was the only one that shot. He put all of his bullets into the cops. The cops never fired back. And then he turns around and Mr. Brown is dead. And I'm like, well, Mr. Brown didn't get shot there. And now that you mention it, I'm like, okay, it's very plausible, and actually not plausible. It's exactly he got shot before they left the jeweler. He got in the car and then died subsequently. So,
they let the guy who got shot in the head be the getaway driver.
I mean, yeah, there's – you want to talk about movie goofs, John. There you go.
Right, yeah. You know what? I'm changing my superhero, my hero, to Mr. Brown for driving while shot in the head.
He got them just far enough away.
Yeah.
It seemed like he was doing all right, and then all of a sudden he was dead, and it was like Tim Robbins after eating the receipt that had been contaminated by mud pie. So, anyway, okay, we are on to the special awards, and so the first one is the Scottiest Scene, and I'm going to go ahead and say Sean playing video games with Zombie Ed at the end of Shaun of the Dead. Of course, Scott, I know, like, so little about you that I've got no reference here, but there you go.
That's really good, actually.
That is really good, yeah. I hadn't even considered that.
All right, what do you think, John?
I went with the Don't Stop Me Now scene.
Oh, that is also equally as good. Those are both good. I like, yeah, good, good. Any one of them is that. Do I get a vote?
Yes, you do, sir.
I keep going back to it, but it's the garden scene for me. That's the Scottiest scene. Yeah. But I like your votes. I like that. Those are great.
So, John, who's the Scottiest character?
This is going back to playing video games, but I went with Mr. Brown because he gets shot in the head a lot.
I am a bullet sponge.
That's really good. So I'm a little boring. I just went with Sean. I thought about Ed, but maybe Ed would have been insulting. So, Sean, but what do you think, Scott? Who's
I guess it depends on how you define Scottiest character. I looked at it as my favorite character, and Ed is my favorite character.
Oh, there you go. Okay, now, Scott, you don't get a vote on this last one because it's probably just going to end up being your favorite film. But the Scottiest movie, John?
It's Shaun of the Dead. I'm just going Shaun of the Dead.
I think it's Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah,
okay. All right, here we go. We're going to rank these guys. And
wait,
I'm
did,
start...
we do, would, did we do unanswered questions already?
I did, and then I didn't let you guys chime in. So, okay, fine. John, what's your unanswered question?
Okay, I already asked, why is the clock in Bill and Ted always ticking? But my other question is, who bought all the Reservoir Dogs matching suits?
Joe? I don't know.
I mean, it's probably just Joe or Eddie, but...
Is that a weird part of it? Like,
I think it's weird because, and... I mean, because you have to know everybody's sizes and everything.
Yeah, that's
or
does
weird. Does he just have a huge closet of suits? He's like, okay, find a suit that fits you because we always rob places in suits like this. Hopefully no one finds my suit warehouse.
Well, yeah, I mean, did he send them to, like, the mafia tailor, right? Like, they all need a...
Yeah.
That's weird. Well, Scott, what's your unanswered question?
when time traveling, is it required to pack 12 tin cans of chocolate pudding?
Right. They had the tin cans. They fed everybody.
They fed everyone chocolate pudding. They were in cans, which I thought was interesting. But that was when they were trying to fix the antenna with the gum.
I guess that's what they carry around instead of textbooks.
Yeah. Just putting
this is why they're failing history.
So I remember, John, were you there? We went to a scout camp where like they just had the paint cans full of pudding, and one of them was butterscotch, and there was a tubby little kid that so the legend now goes, was just like fists in the gallon bucket of butterscotch pudding.
Yeah. I wasn't there, but I was there for the stories.
Yeah. Oh, all right. Okay, so now it's time to rank these darn movies, and Scott, we'll start with you so we can boomerang around and get your number one last. What's your third favorite?
Third favorite of these three would be Reservoir Dogs.
Okay. John, what about you?
Okay, right now, I've seen all of these movies a few times, and so it kind of came down to like what I was in the mood for today. So I will say right now my third favorite actually was Shaun of the Dead. I think watching it this week, it especially felt weirdly exactly 2004, where in previous times where I've watched it, it felt a little bit more timeless. It felt a little bit more specifically in its time this time.
Okay. Well, we're all over the place. My third favorite is Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. And then I'm going to call my number two Shaun of the Dead. John, it's your turn.
Really, really quick. In your Facebook notes, you said at the end, you said you hate it and love it. Yeah. Can you elaborate on that really quick?
So, like, there's some really clever humor and there's some decent writing, but it kind of bugs me that like part of the humor is just based on like listen to how like stupid these guys talk, right? And so like I never laugh at any of the times when they just talk like the Valley Girls, right?
Yeah.
But there's so much more past that to enjoy about the film. Yeah. But like every time like that's the focus of a scene, it just kind of is like okay. So anyway, but that's just me, and I've got terrible taste. So
yep.
John, what's your number two?
My number two, I went with Bill and Ted for number two.
Okay, and then Scott, your number two and your number one.
My number two is Bill and Ted's, and not surprisingly, my number one is and always will be Shaun of the Dead.
It's all coming.
Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah.
All right, so coming back around, John, your number one then is?
I went with Reservoir Dogs this
Reservoir
time.
Dogs.
I think maybe just because it was fun to talk about, you know?
Yeah, so that was my pick too, and I kind of loved that, like, we got to a certain point in the film where I kind of felt like no one's getting out of this alive, but it was kind of fun to see that, like, this group of criminals that just implodes on themselves, right?
Yeah.
So, all right. Fantastic. And, hey, we did all that in less than 3 hours because we're super efficient. Now, it's time to get to the bad news. And I'll just refresh in case there was a miracle.
What if there was a miracle?
I feel like
it's a rite of passage for me at this point.
I feel like we have the rite of passage already.
It's a sequel to the rite of passage.
By the way, our Facebook fans thought that Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Reservoir Dogs, they tied for the same amount of votes for best movie, and then Shaun of the Dead had two votes.
Oh, well, you just opened that poll up like a few hours ago, though. So.
These people are all wrong.
Yeah, those
you
jerks.
You guys need better listeners.
Yeah.
So there's nothing we can do about it. We are watching Dream a Little Dream 2, and I will post to make my brother Josh happy. I'll just go ahead and put poll closed.
There is a chance, because we're forced to watch Dream a Little Dream 2, that what you're hearing right now, listeners, is the final episode of Yours, Mine, and Theirs. we're retiring. We're possibly retiring from the podcast.
Okay. All right, well, I'm going to surprise no one, and I'm going to pick maybe the most underrated of all the Rocky films of Rocky III. We're going to watch Rocky III with Mr. T as Clubber Lang.
That's what you meant. You said I wasn't picking. I thought when you said for sure I wasn't picking, it was because you were picking something obscure. But no, it was because you know I have often complained that this whole podcast is just a long con for you to watch every Rocky movie, which you are now completing.
We're nearly there.
This will be the fifth Rocky movie. Okay.
Is that the case? That can't be the case.
We've watched
one through five except for number three. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Good for you guys.
All right. Well, I was going to pick. In anger of the other two picks, I'm going to get my revenge on the world. By picking a movie that's technically worse than Dream a Little Dream 2. And that's a movie I've always wanted to see, but I've always been afraid to. And I'm like, how it couldn't possibly be that bad, but we're going to find out, because we're watching Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Oh, jeez. My guess is that's going to be work. Nah, I don't know.
But a big factor is that it's readily available right now on Amazon Prime. So
no purchasing. As long as you got the Prime membership, you're good?
Yeah. Yep.
And Rocky 3, everyone owns it, so that's good. Dream a Little Dream 2, I think you're going to have to rent that one on Amazon.
Okay, that's a rental. That's fine. We'll have to take it out of the podcast Patreon that the voters surely are contributing to. They're going to have us watch Dream a Little Dream Part 2. But seriously, actually, no, I got to look this up, because we watched Dream a Little Dream Part 1 because it's famously 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
So there's no reviews from critics. Did it go straight to DVD? I don't know, but there's no critics reviews.
No critical reviews.
Yeah, the fan reviews are not good.
Wow.
Dream a Little Dream 2?
Yeah.
So the people who wanted to watch it hate it.
I guess. I mean, I'm only talking Rotten Tomatoes here, right? But I can't remember what the fan percentage was. It's not zero.
Oh, okay.
Oh my gosh! There's not even like cover art. There's no poster art on Rotten Tomatoes for this film. That's how
IMDb.
Bad.
It's got a whopping 3.7,
which is not probably a slightly less than the 40% on Dream a Little Dream 2. And the only reason I say that I think it would be 40% is because if you're watching this movie, it's because you know what you're getting into, right? And so I think you have a skewed audience that has watched this film, and still 40% of them, 60% of those people who decided consciously to watch this movie, 60% of them still hated it. So here we are.
But I mean, they had 5 years. It came out. It wasn't like the next year after Dream a Little Dream. It was five years later.
So the poster is like some super short cutoff jorts, right? Mm. But I want to believe that that's Corey Feldman's legs and they just shaved them.
Yeah, that's. I don't think they shaved him.
Okay.
Dinger and Bobby's adventure start when a pair of magical sunglasses arrive at the door.
Yeah, boy, that sounds good, doesn't it?
Gonna be fun. Okay, oh, be careful what you dream. It might just come true.
Well, we have to do a comparison of the first on IMDb rankings, though.
So, the question is for you guys. I watched. I'm pretty sure I've seen Dream a Little Dream, but when I was a kid. I'm not going to, but am I going to be lost when I watch Dream a Little Dream 2?
I don't think it matters. The chances that it matters are so remote.
Okay, no, Scott, do this. Do me a favor here. If you want to go the extra mile, and I think it will behoove you to do that, watch Dream a Little Dream 1 and tell me you weren't lost during Dream a Little Dream 1.
That movie makes no sense, and like the end of the film makes no sense, and it's just Corey Feldman being the worst actor. It's so bad. It makes Hulk Hogan look like a good actor in Santa with Muscles. That movie is so bad.
Okay, no,
it's really bad.
Here's a bit of good news. I just found some good news. Dream a Little Dream 2 is ranked. It's got a 3.7 rating on IMDb, whereas Dream a Little Dream 1 has a 5.8 rating on IMDb. I was kidding about the good news. It's bad. This is bad.
Do we not have is Robart in this one? Do we get Robart?
Well, I'm not going to look. I don't want any spoilers for Dream a Little Dream 2. But I feel like I have to do it. I'm so compelled to watch Dream a Little Dream 2 because I've been thinking so much about Dream a Little Dream for the past year. Like, it's been on my mind constantly. It's like this it's pretty much, I told you this last time, it's like at the end of The Vanishing when the guy meets the killer and he knows the killer is going to lead him to his grave, but he just has to have, he has to open up the box to make sure his girlfriend is in there or something. Like, I have to do that with Dream a Little Dream 2. I have to accomplish this. It's been very important to me because I've been thinking of Dream a Little Dream so much. And why am I thinking so much about Dream a Little Dream? I don't think about Dream a Little Dream. I think about how angry it makes me, and I just feel like this. I need closure by watching Dream a Little Dream 2.
So I think of all the trilogy of my of the three worst movies we've done, this one like made me the angriest. Like I was angry to be watching it. Like so Assassin's Creed was just so bad, but it wasn't funny bad. It was just so bad. But I think this one made me the most angry. So probably my least favorite movie. Oh man! Oh, it was so bad. The good news is after this set. So hey, fans, at least you get to watch Rocky III. Okay, so at least we got Rocky III.
Yeah, we get the fourth best original Rocky movie.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that's probably correct. So I'm assuming that that the Rotten Tomato percentage for this one is going to be like 22% or something. I don't know. The good news is after that, we have, Phil Burkett on and we will have his movies. So there'll be no voting on movies this go around. We'll have Phil, tell us what his movies are going to be, but we got to figure out what the category is going to be for Phil's second podcast. Talk to John. I talked to you about this a little bit because there's one that was the random pick, but it's kind of perfect. And I really, really want it to get chosen. But it's called World War II. And this is where we watch one German film, one French film, one British film, and I would make it a four-movie podcast and throw in an Italian film. Just do Axis Allies.
Wow.
Nice. Yeah.
Okay.
And then, you know, we can have Phil's take on all that. What if we ended up with a bunch of, like, classic films and Phil actually only cares about movies like Conan the Barbarian? So maybe it'll be really painful for him. I don't know.
Might be.
That's the random one. Scott, what's your category?
I like the music theory category. Narrative movies about real music events.
Ooh.
That's good. Yeah, I don't think that's been nominated, but I really like that one.
Is that one from our...
that's from your list. I'm not creative enough to come up with something better than your 112 list. So.
You didn't want to do the Zhivagatorium where we have to watch 400 movies. So what number was that guy? So I can just...
79.
Music theory. Narrative movies about real art event. Real music. 24-hour party people. La Bamba straight out of Compton. Okay, that could be really interesting.
Yeah, I can think of several movies just off the top of my head that are better than those choices. The Straight Outta Compton wasn't bad.
Okay, and mine was 66. Let me make sure I got the...
That one does sound really interesting. A German movie, a French movie, but they don't have to be war movies. That's just...
No, not at all. And if I had my druthers, I think for German, I would watch like M, right? We could watch M.
Mm-hmm.
An Italian, maybe a spaghetti western, I don't know. British, it'd be fun to watch Repulsion. But anyway, there's so many good movies.
I want to see Repulsion.
Have you never seen it?
Nope.
It is really bizarre, but it's really good. Have you seen Belle de Jour?
Nope.
It's that same actress. Okay.
Is that Catherine Deneuve?
Yes, it's her.
If.
Okay, so mine is good old number 105, and which means nothing to our listeners. It's called East Meets West, and I like this one because we haven't done this in a long time. This would be a six movie podcast, and it is samurai movies and their western remakes. So you'd have Seven Samurai, Magnificent Seven, or you could do Yojimbo, Fistful of Dollars, Adventures of Zaitochi, and The Blind Man, or Harakiri and Requiem for a Gringo, or Rashomon and The Outrage. Those are the only ones I could find, so it's a short list. But we could watch some samurai movies and their western remakes.
So we'll be watching 6 out of the 10 available.
6 out of the 10 available. yes, indeed. So, anyway, that's what we got going, folks. So...
Okay.
And that's the podcast.
So,
hey, I just want to thank you again, Scott, for coming on. This was the time that you got to have fun, and next podcast, you have to come back.
You put
sorry.
The work in. Yeah, it's like penance.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I feel bad now for saying yes. I was feeling good up until 10 minutes ago.
It'll be great. We need you to help us get through next week. And I realize I have one more bit of good news, you guys. Highlander 2 has a higher IMDb rating than Dream a Little Dream 2. However, it is lower than the original Dream a Little Dream.
So, but now Highlander, the original Highlander is a legitimately good movie. So
I love the original Highlander so much. So
it'll
so
be interesting much. To yeah. see how the movie could have fallen so precipitously. Yeah,
exactly. And I haven't seen Highlander 1 in 35 years.
How is that possible?
30 years.
How do you live without seeing Highlander?
I probably watched that in the early 2000s. That was probably, or sorry, the early 90s, I mean. It was probably the last time I saw it.
Wow, you probably saw it around the same time Highlander 2 came out.
Probably.
Man, you were probably so pumped to see Highlander 2 that you're like, I have to see Highlander 1 first, and I'll see Highlander 2 30 years later.
I will watch Highlander 1 and Highlander 2 for this.
Well, Highlander 1 is just, I mean, that's pleasure.
I know. It's one of those ones that, you know, I've always meant to get back to, but just never have.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movies out there.
Wait, didn't you watch Highlander 1? We did a commentary with Highlander 1. Weren't you there?
I did not do that, no. I didn't do a lot of those commentaries. That was mostly Zoe.
You should have been there. All right. Well, Highlander 1 is great. Don't let me talk it up because a lot of people don't think it's great. A lot of people say it does not age well, but...
I can't imagine.
But it ages well to me. So...
All right, John. So let's do some administration here. So, folks, if you want to listen to any of our old podcasts, like if you want to hear us talking about comparing The Thing from Another World versus The Thing, you can do that. That's our first podcast officially for this, under this Yours, Mine, and Theirs moniker. And to do so, you need to go to Yours, Mine, Theirs podcast.blogspot.com. And, John, if people want to communicate with us, what's the best way?
The best way is, well, honestly, it's through Facebook, but also email is a pretty good way. Yours, Mine, Theirs podcast@gmail.com. But probably the best way is by leaving us a review on iTunes or Apple Music as it is now, or whatever it is. Leave us a review through, you know, the system, the podcasting systems, and, well, 5 stars. The review doesn't matter so much, but the 5 stars, that's the best. We'll know what you mean when you leave us 5 stars.
Can I send you 5 stars through the mail?
Yeah, apparently you can. The mail is also a good way. My address is public knowledge, so go ahead and send another letter directly to me, and I'll read it over the air. So go ahead and do that. Oh, hey, you know what else? Give us a call. 801-896-4542. 801-896-4542. We'll definitely play your call on the air. So that's your chance to just totally tell us how terrible we are, and we'll play it. We'll do it. and you know, you can disguise your voice in a robot voice or something, if you're scared about that. But the number is 801-896-4542. It'll go right to voicemail, and we'll play it.
All right. And John, where does all the magic happen?
All the magic happens here on my computer, and also on my computer is the blog, which is Yours, Mine, Theirs podcast.blogspot.com. If you go there, you can see great pictures of all the movies we cover, and also direct MP3 downloads of everything. So if you don't want to deal with those, you know, podcast aggregates or whatever, however those work, if you don't want to do that, if you just want to listen to something straight, you can click on any of the MP3 links. It'll play on whatever device you have, unless you're, you know, on a device that doesn't have sound, which I don't know if any... I guess it won't... It might not play on your Kindle. Maybe. I don't know. Do Kindles have speakers, the ones that access the internet? It should play on everything. Like, yeah. Try to find a device where it doesn't play. But if you go to yoursmindtheirspodcast.blogspot.com, you can hear it. So you can hear everything.
everything. So, there.
Yep. And if you actually want to be involved in helping us pick films and pick categories, you got to come find us on Facebook.
Yes, yes. We have the next 3 podcasts scheduled, but after that, we're open. So if you want to come on, yeah, we want you to bring your movies. We want to do the movies that made you, and then, of course, the week after, the Penance movies that you'll have to watch. Yeah,
then you'll have to watch Dream a Little Dream Part 3 or whatever.
We should make that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, gents. It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Scott, for coming on again, and yes, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. And in the meantime, everyone get going on Dream a Little Dream Part 2, Rocky 3, and Highlander 2, The Quickening. And it's been a pleasure, and have a good one.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Gosh. It's so funny how it's like the biggest list of selections ever, and it's just like all of these are just like... I mean, Dream a Little Dream 2 is right out, but then also all the rest are just like, why would I ever watch this?
See, I realized that all those times when Zoe was on and I purposely voted for the ones that I knew Zoe would hate the most, maybe wasn't the best idea.
When you mute Skype, it still records.
Oh, does it?
Yes.
Oh, then I guess I won't bother muting Skype.
I guess you didn't listen to the 101 live commentary. There were like three sequences where it was just full-on conversations with your family instead of anything else.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. So for my echo, can you like, is there the opposite of reverb? Can you unverb and then...
I don't think so. I think one thing I can do is add echo to everybody else.
Add echo to everyone else.
And then it's unscripted, and then that's where the ums start. That's where the ums come into town.
So when you're editing, can you just do a control F for and then just delete all the ums automatically?
That might be. I could almost... I see when I'm looking through the whole thing, and I see a little thing that's shaped a certain way, and it has space, this much space. Like, I'm like, oh, that's an That's an That's an
You recognize the
I can recognize it. It's like viewing the Matrix. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's that right there.